There are a few of our members who will join us because we are seeing a very important proceeding. And we also want to thank you for sending us some documents in advance. It was quite useful. But this is your show today. All right. This is your show. We're looking forward to a very fruitful engagement with you. In terms of time, we want to be finished here by the latest after 12, the very latest. And I think we should be able to make it. There are a few apologies. Members who just slipped out, those who have already indicated to me, I'm not at liberty to divulge who they are.
They'll be seen.
All right, Professor Reddy, shall I hand over to you? I'm sure you know the drill by now. I don't have to take you through the process.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair, again, and good morning, members of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee. As usual, it really is a pleasure for the NRF to meet with you this time to discuss the strategy and the business plan for 2008 onwards. We have become accustomed over many engagements with the Portfolio Committee to fascinating range of questions, probing questions, all of which make for an interesting discussion and one which adds value to the work of the NRF. So we are looking forward to more of the same today. Chair, what I would like to do next is to introduce our team who are all the way down this end of the table. I'm sure most of them are familiar to members of the committee, but let me nevertheless go over the whole team. I'll start right on my left here with Professor Mzama Mangalisa, who is the President and CEO of the NRF. And on my right is Dr. Daisy Selebatsela, who is a manager in the Directorate of Knowledge Management and Evaluation. Then perhaps I should go down to the end. Albert, are you the first one down there? I'm keeping a low profile next to Dr. Albertson Yarsfeld, who's Vice President. And on his right is Ms. Marcel Pinon-Marais, who's the head of our governance, corporate governance unit. Then on her right is Dr. Marx, who's the corporate secretary. On her right is Mr. McLean Sibanda, who's a senior patent attorney in the Innovation Fund. Then we have Ms. Vishen Singh, who's the executive director of finance. And on his right, Mr. Patrick Thompson, who's our executive director for human resources. Then we have Mr. Robert Krieger, who is director in the policy and strategy office of the CEO. And I'm Professor Dyer Reddy, who's chair of the NRF board. So those are the introductions, Chair. What we would like to do, members of the Portfolio Committee have a copy of the business plan, and you should also have a copy of the presentation of the slides. I would like us to commence now with the presentation by Professor Mangalisa, which will essentially take us through the business plan, the highlights, the key points, and so on. And then thereafter, I presume there will be a round of questions from members of the committee. So if that's in order with you, Chair, we could go ahead with the presentation.
No, that's quite in order. Whilst Professor Mangalisa is preparing, let me also just members, just introduce yourselves to the NRF, you see, because some of them are quite new here. Let's start with Mr. Slau.
My name is Joe Slau, member of the committee.
I'm begging the angle.
Professor Mangalisa, I'm giving you a chance to go to them.
Okay.
We're playing for time.
We're really all set. Okay, long-time member of this committee.
I follow a member of this committee. For ANC, a member of this committee. Adam?
Peterson, a member of this committee, who did not go to the Women's Forum?
Ah. members. My name is Godfrey Mulikwanda. I'm chairing this committee. I just want to make this announcement because you might see it on the news today. The Minister of Science and Technology will be given a doctorate, awarded with a doctorate by the Vale University of Technology today. So I think if we can just get the message that we have before him. Thanks. Yeah, that would be Dr. Sibudi Mangena. Mangena. No, in Limpopo they call him Mangena. Prof, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. As one of the members of the UCT of Science and Technology, it's our pleasure in the NRF to once again come and visit with you and engage in discussing about the activities of the NRF as we, move into the future, the rest of the year until next year. The business plan of the NRF for 2008-2009 through 2010-2011 is contained in the next few slides. I will go quite quickly through the slides. I was told for something like 30 minutes and then allow enough time for a discussion on the topic. However, if there's any point at which you'd like to stop me, please feel free to do so to address any concerns that you might have.
Somebody might just want to switch on the mic next to you there because just for we are recording what you say.
A plan that reflected the desires and the wishes of
day about stakeholders. And that became known as NRF Vision 2015, which is at this time being compiled and being finished up and is going to be distributed in the form of about 22, 23 page booklet. That's a high flying document that guides the operations of the NRF through 2015. The key of the NRF Vision 2015 is this. We changed the vision from the original vision that said that the NRF sees South Africa and Africa as a continent that's immersed in a culture of knowledge, free of poverty in its attendant diseases, and proud contributors to the well-being of all of humanity. Very long-winded vision, but it's lofty, it makes you feel proud of belonging to the NRF. We reduced it to these three phrases here. World-class research, a transformed society, and sustainable environment. That's very easy to remember. Wake you up in the middle of the night and say, recite the vision of the NRF. You do this much easier. And the idea here is for the benefit of the present and future generations. When we talk about species of equity and regress and all that, we are not talking only about equity and regress among the circles of society here. We're also talking in a vertical sense that those that will come and inherit the planet after us will also get each species of equity and redress. So we need for them a very livable planet, which is why this last phrase here was important. Of course, world-class research, we benchmark ourselves by world-class standards and transform society. We believe that the space of research in South Africa must reflect the space of South Africa as a whole. Because intelligence, excellence, is evenly distributed among all ethnicities, among language groups, among all genders, and so on and so forth. South Africa is not in that way. And this is the key to it. In other words, all three of these things are challenges that we have to work on. Hence the vision 2015. We may not get there by 2015, but I think by the end, by this time, we'll say how far have we gone towards transforming, towards excellence, and towards sustainable environment. Whereupon, bringing it down to mission, said that our idea is to help South Africa contribute to the knowledge economy here by attaining 1% of global R&D. Currently, we are a little less than 0.4% of global R&D. And we presume that global R&D, many other nations will be wanting to increase their contribution. So it's a finite pie. So as they increase their contribution, it has an impact on our shrinking. So we started off by saying 2%, but we thought that was a stretch. Let's bring it down to 1. And if we end up with 0.7 or 0.8, it's getting there. That's the idea of long-range planning. And then this whole strategic plan is linked to the DSP, the 10-year innovation plan, which has 4 pillars support the knowledge economy. These pillars are the economic and institutional regime that exists in any country, the educational system within that country, the informational infrastructure, and innovation. Then they're all interconnected. But the NRF contributes particularly on this one here through three means. Knowledge capital, in other words, growing that human capacity, and the knowledge capital through the programs that we support. The human capital itself, and we'll talk later about the PhD project as the driver of the human capital acquisition, and then of course the research infrastructure. Unlike any of the other councils we've spoken with, the NRF has physical infrastructure through the national research facilities, which are laboratories for universities, each of which cannot afford to pay the equipment in those national facilities. We are the capital custodians of that. So through those three ways, we contribute to the knowledge economy. And here are the strategic goals of our strategic plan. There's 5. To promote international competitive research for the knowledge economy, and again, we underscore the international competitiveness of our research. We want to grow a representative science and technology workforce, as I said. The face of research in South Africa must reflect the face of the citizens of South Africa as a whole. Provide cutting-edge research, technology, and innovation platforms through the various facilities that we run, and then operate a world-class evaluation and grant-making facilities system. And this here is borne out by the fact that increasingly we are getting scientists from all over the world writing to the NRF requesting for us to evaluate their portfolio because they're coming up for promotion in their own countries and their own universities. So it's almost like people who want to come to South Africa
for benchmarking how excellent they are.
So that's what is getting to the world class. And they, of course, contribute to a vibrant national innovation system, which stands without faith in the knowledge economy. They have to be innovation. There are several core competencies we ride on in the MLX. As I said, the grant payment system. We believe that that's second to none in the system here. The research evaluation system, where we evaluate professors' research, again, judged by the fact that people come from all over the world to subject themselves to us, we are good at that. State-of-the-art research platform, we will talk a little bit about those later. Research capacity at national research facilities, these are researchers who are linked worldwide with other researchers in order to increase our research capacity here. We have design advancement expertise within our organization, and the SMT management expertise that exists is also one of our core competencies. Strategic information accumulation and dissemination, as Dr. Srivastava over there will testify, with the RIM project that we have and others, we have a world-class strategic information accumulation and dissemination, and the Department of Science and Technology is pushing us more and more in that direction. Catalyzing local and international research cooperation networks through our international program. We have become regarded as the port of call in many people, many countries around the world trying to access Africa. They regard South Africa as the gateway to Africa. So in that regard, we have that core competence. How do we put it all together? We put it all together in the form of this diagram that shows the relationship between the NRS vision and actually what we were composed of. We're composed of the research and innovation, support and advancement, what we call RITA, that actually consumes or utilizes about 75% of the allocation we have. We also have national research facilities, but we also participate strongly in the public S&T education and outreach from CASA. All of these go to support this vision we have of world-class research, transform society, and a sustainable environment. Now let's take a look at these pieces of the NRF one by one, beginning with RITA, which stands for Research, Innovation, Support, and Advancement. What is the value addition of RITA in the system? We have the overarching emphasis on human capacity development, knowledge management, and evaluation there. We provide comprehensive grant making and management service, and we manage a lot of peer-reviewed evaluations that go through the system, the mechanisms for independent and objective decision-making. Because the conception is that the NRF makes these decisions. We don't. It's the researchers out there, the experts, the leading experts in whatever field, that give input to us. All we do is collate the information and find and make conclusions out of those inputs. Applying expertise and experience of research management, e.g., we have the centers of excellence that have been established around the country. We have the South African Research Chairs Initiative, of which Mr. Mangera has inaugurated earlier on, and we are aiming to have 210 of these by the year 2010, of which we have allocated some 70 or so. We are one third of the way. And we're learning through this process of allocating as we go to the next one-third before we finalize those 210 research chairs. But the expertise of that research is honed in by the NRF, facilitated, and then promoted at the university themselves. We serve the system, serving system initiatives through partnerships. We have partnerships with DST, of course, but with API, with the Department of Labor, Department of Trade and Industry, Department of Environmental and I'm learning very quickly on this. And also the Department of Labor, we have it done. So we do a lot of partnerships, but RITA is at the center of me of facilitating those. The next group of next lab of the MRF comprises the National Research Facility. The first one is the nuclear facilities themselves. This is where we're looking at subatomic particles, protons and neutrons that get accelerated at high speed. to, for example, be able to treat cancers and tumors and things like that at the ITEMBER, ITPTC, ITEMBER Particle Therapy Center. Very, very important as far as that treatment is concerned. In fact, some of the things we can talk about a little later have been approved to go forward in that respect, treating cancer. We have another cluster of facilities that are in the Astrospace Geoscience Cluster. The South African Astronomical Observatory at Arts and Southernland, we have the headquarters are in Cape Town, but we have the Southern African Large Telescope Project at Arts and Southernland there. We have shareholderships from different countries around the world in SALT Incorporated that are able to observe the southern skies in a way that no other telescope can in the Southern Hemisphere. In fact, this is the biggest telescope in the Southern Hemisphere, and South Africa is proud to have won that from a competitive process of bidding internationally. We also are pursuing interest in Hermanus Magnetic Observatory. This is the observatory that looks at the effects of the Earth's axis and magnetism in the atmosphere. As you can see here, you've got a lot of solar wind coming from the sun, and the magnetism of the Earth has an effect of protecting the crust of the Earth or the atmosphere around us, and also defraying any of the radiation, the dangerous radiation that comes from the sun. But that polarity tends to reverse itself at some point. And also it's very helpful to have an observation point in the southern part of Africa that contributes to the weather monitoring around the world. And in fact, Hermanus have been invited to join the international weather observation system around the world. We also have the Hartlauer here, the Hartlauer Radio Astronomical Observatory that is based in Hartlauer. That's a 26-meter antenna that was left by the NASA people who used to observe the deep skies and listen to some of the radio emissions that come from the outer atmosphere. We have the SKA, the Square Kilometer Array project. This is a big science project that the international astronomical community, the radio astronomy community, have out for bidding for somebody to host it in the southern hemisphere. There were seven bidders for this, and we're down to two, and we won with two, the other being Australia. And I believe the answer will come, the result will come in 2011 or 2012, who's going to win. So we're in the process of beefing up our capacity in radio astronomy, and we're hoping that South Africa will speak well of us and have to beat the Australians. But it's very, very tough, ladies and gentlemen. I have to say that we will need your support as we make our pitches, especially through the South African Research Chairs Initiative, to attract some of the big names in astronomy to come and base themselves in South Africa. Just an example, which you probably know, we had one we almost had at the University of Western Cape by the name of Professor Hardy Butcher that we missed out because the Australians made a better bid to them, with him and his wife. What we overlooked was the fact that here the wife was also a professor. And so the Hardy made a bid for both husband and wife. And of course, South Africans were hedging about the wife, what to do with it, with her. And at the end of the day, we accepted the Australian offer. And I think that meant that the thought is that we should be very
attentive.
So please, if we ever get into those ears, I can listen in terms of promoting research and making strong offers, competitive offers to some of the top guys. Please help us there. And the final group of facilities is the Biodiversity Cluster, comprising the South African Institute of Aquatic Biodiversity, the National Zoological Gardens there, and the South African Earth Observatory Network. These are calculated to preserve biodiversity in the country, either whether it's the animals or the aquatic or the just the observing the earth around all over the place. Those are the three, and we have a lot of learning that goes on here. As you can see the pictures of students here, capacity building, exciting people about science, In fact, right now there's an initiative at the zoo where the life sciences centers, where our tractor people are making outreach to learners who are young and old to understand more about that topic. All right, and then we go to the national facilities and the challenges and what the national science facilities, what the national research facilities present for the system. There are large equipment or facilities for research that are made available to all learners in all universities that not any single university can afford on its own. They provide opportunities for cutting-edge research in those areas. So we talk about December labs and particle acceleration and those kinds of things. It's very, very state-of-the-art. Opportunities for human capital development, yes, of a different range. We know that the universities have limited capacity, but these human capital development projects taking place there in a vivid place where people can get excited about what they see, and attracting and facilitating international collaborators, we do, as I said, by attracting those among the best in the world. And in fact, also what happened was, once people get to be aware around the world what we're capable of doing in South Africa, either through SALT or through the SKA or other projects, then they want to come and collaborate with our researchers here and invite our researchers to go to their country. The potential for networking, I've just covered that, and the opportunities for science awareness, education, and communication, as you'll see in the next slide, proves up in the outreach. And this is the South African Agency for Science and Technology Advancement. The pictures you see here indicate how SANTA reaches out to younger learners. These are primary school kids who are, in this case, participating in an astronomy contest. And 15 schools were involved around the nine provinces. And five were finalists. From those five, there were at least three that were from historically disadvantaged schools, such as Soshanguve and other places, which to me was a very successful outreach there. In fact, the winner was from the Western Cape here, which got a bit of excitement. The exciting thing about it is students, for the first time, get to talk about science. They get to experience science. And from a very young age, which some of us never had the chance to do, and so they can aspire to become scientists later. What does the software do in advancing science? They have three basic ways of advancing science. Using the science awareness platform, as I said, you know, the observatory in Johannesburg, the museum, the zoo, and then, of course, the science mission through school science support, science materials that are provided, and career counseling with SET. This is a very important part because what we've observed is that more and more young people are attracted to the commercial world because of the promise of getting higher pay and higher material wealth that way, and not yet to understand and catch up on what science can offer in terms of advancing our state of living here and understanding nature as a whole. The science communication platform comprises science and the media, with all the media releases we have, communication of research to public audiences in a way that engages talent and communities at large, so that the learners, when they get home, they find an atmosphere that supports science itself. So to work with these together is very important as we create a society that's knowledge and science-oriented. Well, the NLF is driven by a number of investment principles that are listed in this slide. The principle of competitive funding is fundamental in what we do. We may seem to be driving a certain agenda and so on, but at the core of our operations is competitiveness. We involve peers and we have people make a judgment for anything that we make an evaluation on and then use that to allocate funding. But at the same time, we strive for a balance between strategic push, in other words, pushing for those things we want to see in the system, versus curiosity-driven, demand-pull kind of project. The merit basis of our review, which is very rigorous, is very important. We want to see transformation, as you saw in the vision there, and excellence at the same time, world-class transformed society. We marry these two together, but we're saying now they will be monitored and rewarded, and failure to conform to any of these will have consequences. No longer are we going to turn a blind eye if somebody goes off on his own way and public monies that are allocated to them without paying attention of what the primary needs of the country are. We are using the PAP as a driver because we believe that there will be a reason you'll see in the next slide. The cross-fertilization of talent within the NFI, we believe that increasingly we should be getting people to understand what goes on around us. For example, we have a lot of professors and doctors sitting this side of the table, over this side too. But it's almost as if we're exclusively focused on the science council, when some of us should be involved with universities at some point through either releases for limited periods or as we do our job through direct research at universities. We are opening up channels for people in the universities to rotate out into the science council and spend a year or so, 6 months, understanding how the science councils work in order to increase the cross-fertilization. Effective goal-oriented resource allocation. Now, of course, if you have voted some money of the state payer's money to this science council, we have to have effective and goal-oriented resource allocation. In other words, allocate our resources to accomplish those goals that have been set for us by the policy decision makers yourself. And then, of course, fairness and transparency and accountability. What can I say? That's very important. That's part of our constitution in South Africa. Here are the seven investment areas that we have started to work on as part of this coming year. We have a certain allocation to established researchers. We have money for capital development and for unrated researchers. We have strategic knowledge here. We have strategic platforms. We have international initiatives applied in industrial research innovation. I see that there are people from Stockholm here that just walked out. And then community engagement research, which is a little bit off the original money, that's the student process. Now, when about these established researchers, not a generation, we have guaranteed funding for rated research starting this year. Just to fill you in, members of the GTC, that for the last few years, when people got rated, they got no money, they received no money. They have subsequently to submit a proposal for funding. But before that, before we merged the CMC and the FRD to form the NRF, people once got rated, they got a lump sum of money. We're going back to that system now, having a lump sum of money set aside for people once they get rated. If you get an A rating, for example, there will be an 80,000 rand a year for you for the duration of your time. If you're rated B, there will be a 40,000. If you're rated C, there will be 20,000 or something like that. If you're rated P or L or Y, we have a matching arrangement. P are the president of what we need. This is a young scholars who have a promise to become top rated researchers in the world. We have a matching system whereby the NRF will give them 20,000 a year and the university will give them 20,000 to make a total of 40,000 a year. So there will be a lump sum of money for rated researchers set aside. That is what we heard coming from the constituents, is that this whole rating process is so rigorous, but at the end of the day, we end up empty-handed. We have normal competitive funding for research proposals as a whole, and the statistic you see here may sound alarming, that of all the research proposals we get, we can only fund 40% of fundable research proposals. In other words, 60% of fundable research proposals end up not getting any money because we don't have enough money. We'll talk about the problems we have with the MTEF application, not keeping up with inflation here. But in other countries that are advanced, this money is even less, the expense is even less, but they have sources of funding in other ways. The NRF currently funds about 30% of student applications. And when we do that, there's also the question of how much we fund those students. Considerable room for increased investment in human capital. That's the conclusion of this slide. We really sorely desire to have more money allocated to human capital as development. What is this human capital development? As far as unrated researchers here, we have a number of funding programs for them that will continue. For example, the Tutuka Fund will continue to happen, where the special treatment of interventions for black female researchers and institutional capacity development that will continue in this current plan. One of the programs we have will continue. As I said, the Chichuka Fund will continue and several others that are in that field. The human capital development, again, in terms of urban we've seen a 30% growth over the last 2 years in the number of students supported. The total number of students supported in 2006-07 was 4,458. In the current year, we're looking at 4,431, but the actual is still pending. Perhaps we'll match the last year's figure and maybe even go over. The target for 2008, 2008 and 9 is about 5,062 supported students. There are revised values that we want to allocate for bursary. For example, the final year and the graduate full-time, we didn't allocate any money in this current year, but we're planning to allocate 8,000 for students in the undergraduate program. These are fewer by comparison with the graduate program because the NRF space operations mostly in graduate program. As far as we are for honors, right now, this column actually shows you the numbers that we support students by in the various degree levels. I am told that it costs 16,000 rand to pay your fees for an honors program degree. But we're currently funding students at 8,000. In other words, we fund them at half the level they're supposedly funded it. The same thing happens to these other degrees. What we're going to do with immediate effect at the NRF is to double that amount and fund people at the honors at 15,000, fund people for master's degrees at 30,000, and 45,000 for doctoral degrees, with postdocs going up to 80,000. This way, we think that this is much more meaningful for people to choose to do an honors than to drop out and go and work and make money. As we know, many of those who come from historically disadvantaged backgrounds are supported by extended family members, aunts and uncles, but there are also nephews and nieces who are waiting for them to finish schooling so they can help them. But if we did this, we will be taking a half a step towards helping them be able to fulfill those obligations. We are hoping, Chair, that at the end of the day, we will up this amount even further and make it competitive with what they would get in the workplace so people, it's easy for them to choose to stay and do an honors by upping this thing to 40,000. There's a table that you'll see later that addresses those increased amounts. But this immediate step that we're taking effectively came not as a result of an increase in the allocation, Chair. It came as a result of our efficiency, charging our efficiencies within the NRF. By raising and scraping money and making sure that money is not lying around unwasted, and putting all that money to use to help the students find some help in their honors and masters and PhD. We are talking with the Department of Science and Technology to throw something, and that word is falling into very, very listening ears. We're hoping that we'll be able to take it to the next level. The biggest driver we have here is the PhD as a driver, and this is a program that the NRF has always said this since that the PhD was adopted as a driver. I believe it was in 2004 that the PhD as a driver was adopted. But this year we've decided to put muscle into the PhD as a driver and take it to a very operational level, because we believe that large numbers of PhDs in the system will be the bedrock for innovation, for creation of knowledge in the knowledge and entrepreneurial economy. Why then do we choose the PhD as a target? Here are the reasons. We believe it's the pinnacle qualification by definition. If you want to create knowledge, it's the broadening of the frontiers of knowledge here. And a lot of PhDs do contribute to job creation, especially in a knowledge-intensive sense. Only 37% of staff at universities that teach have PhDs. This compares very unfavorably with other countries. PhD student supervision ratio here in South Africa is 10 to 1, which is double what's supposed to be an ideal, 5 to 1. And we know, according to Peter Drucker, 85% of the jobs in the knowledge economy reside in the trade. And of course, the investment in humans is very key to competitive advantage of any nation, according to Michael Porter. Well, this slide you probably saw the last time we were here addresses the question of the PhD, the pipeline itself.
And I don't need to spend too much time over it, Jeff, you know and are familiar with it. Suffice it to say, we think that 1,200 is very small. We want to increase that number by 2025, five times as much as that, so that we can be competitive with countries such as Korea and South Korea and so on and so forth. But point of care is, if you look at the numbers, the drastic drop here from 15,000 to 3,200 in S&T, to us, signifies something more serious about the way that the didactics and the pedagogy goes on at school. We think that if you were just to shift those efficiencies and make the system a little bit more efficient by moving it from 43% throughput to 57% throughput, we can reach those targets much sooner. If you take it the next, look at the next slide here, you'll see what I mean. Yeah? This graph here shows you the number of people enrolled in PhDs from Soho. You can see that it's risen by something like 3,000 over the years. But look at the output of PhDs here. The gap is widening. That number hovers around 1,000. Like I said, it's 1,200 lately. Why is this? This is an inefficiency. Part of the reason is people take 10 years to finish their PhD. People are just frustrated and drop out and so on and so forth. So what we want to do is transform this and make it work a little more efficiently and with a little more aggression. But there's a program that used to exist some time ago that we're going to be reviving. Chair, this graph here just demonstrates for you the 34 countries in the world of which the statistics were maintained by the OECD group. They can be categorized in terms of three leagues. The first league is the league that produces 230 PhDs per million of population per year. And these countries include Germany, UK, Switzerland, Sweden, and so on and so forth. We have a D league here that comprises countries that have 100 or more PhDs per million of population per year. And that league is the US, Japan, Spain, South Korea, Australia, the Netherlands, Norway, and so on. And then there's the C league to which we belong, South Africa. And you can see the company in that league. And we're saying that South Africa really should move from this league here to at least to that league of 100 plus. And this, how do we do it? We have to push it a little higher along the same line that I talked about earlier. Now, there's what we call the PhD project that we're starting to launch in South Africa. It was actually launched last November by Minister Mangena. At that point, he didn't have a PhD. So we made the comment that all the people that are speakers here have PhDs except for me. And I think today that mistake will be corrected. He launched it in Pretoria, and I think the chair also attended. You remember what went on there, Chair. This May, we'll be having the official fair that's conducted with invited students now, which are numbering as of now, I don't know how many now we're going to have students for the PhD fair. About 300 students who are invited, potential students, to come here and then interact with people from higher education institutions, international higher education institutions, and science councils, because some of the science councils also support PhDs. They will have tables installed around on a Thursday, on a Tuesday, I think. We have sponsors who come from government. At this point, it's just the DST, which is the sponsor. We're talking to others. We will have speakers, motivational speakers, government speakers, research DVCs, and successful PhD people talk about the importance of PhDs, and we'll have overseas partners. The EOC is a South African-based organization that recruited a whole bunch of people back in the 70s and the 80s, that went to the United States and participated in programs, and the next slide shows you this program, which was one of the most successful in the 1980s and 90s. It produced close to 2,000 students at U.S. universities, and the return rate there was about 95%, in excess of 95%, who now hold senior positions in South Africa in various tiers of life. You can see the diagram that I showed you there before in the next half page. If you look at the...
What is that? What is that?
We have had a slide here that highlighted several people, but maybe I should highlight one person over here.
Approach.
In the National Research Foundation, we were not as strong as this, but one way to placate that hope is to get faculty, people who are professors at universities and lecturers, to rotate into the LRF as a research fellow. That has been done at the National Science Foundation of America. We have studied how they're doing it, we'll continue to study it and infuse it in our midst by creating a ramp of people at the director level who are going to be research fellows to inject this discipline basis in what we do. Well, the specific platforms, again, the National Research Facilities, the rollout plan for the next 5 years. As I was saying, the hot lava people are ramping up the operational integration of the square kilometer array activities, such as the Karoo Array Telescope, the Meerkat, and the Space Geodesy. We're looking at FAO ongoing commissioning of the SOL, the Southern African Large Telescope Project. At HMO, we are seeking funding for the Itabati project that looks at the effect of the core of the Earth on outer space. We have a proposal coming through with that. The acceleration of ASAP, and the Therion, eventually the rollout of nodes around the country, and the zoo. We're looking at increasing the research capability at the zoo. The zoo has been, up to now, be a place where people come and see animals. The animals are just kept. But we're switching it to a research facility, and of course the Life Sciences Center, in collaboration with FAO, will be one of the key lights there. Highlights there. At the Tama level, I said the Tama Particle Therapy Center, which is used by oncologists around South Africa, is well underway. And finally, with RIPA, we're looking at this big, ambitious project that's called LIMS, and the details of which we can talk about in the discussion, and Dr. Slimotela is here to help us out with that dream. There are several international initiatives we have. We're trying to rationalize and streamline international activities by reaching out to peer countries in the South, but also the South-North relationship. We want to strengthen international collaboration a lot more than we have right now. But the focus will always remain on Africa, because as Africa goes, so does South Africa. The review and reinforcement of support for the ISU Regional Office for Africa. ISU is one of those that we did it for, and we received to be the location where ISU Regional Office for Africa is located in Pretoria. We won over, I believe, Zimbabwe and Nairobi, which did it for that office. And what has happened with ISU now, they've developed 4 science plans that were bottom-up, created by professors from all over Africa, that are calculated to address some of the grand challenges that we mentioned here. And those plans are ready to be rolled out as we speak. Science awareness, we established research programs on community engagement in science. We want to operationalize science outreach activities as a refurbished Johannesburg Observatory site, and we want to increase the collaboration with the Department of Education on the Sinhalese School MSc program. Then a little bit about the Innovation Fund. As you know, the Innovation Fund has not been a central part of our planning going forward now, because it's being phased out to be incorporated under TIA, the Technology and Innovation Agency. However, it suffices to remind people as we consider the Innovation Fund that the Innovation Fund is something that doesn't bring about immediate payoff in the investment areas that we do. For example, if you take the biotech area, go up to 9 years in terms of time before you can see positive returns. Most of the time is that the investment is money for a long time, and most of these, as you can see, starting from point zero, there's money being injected there, invested to develop R&D, to do all these other things before you can start to see it come up with a return on investment. For ICT, that's a little quick and a little cleaner. They have even new materials, steel. And of course, biotech is the longest investment time. But the thing about this is the application for IP takes place much earlier so that you can protect user of letting it go away in the way that has been happening in South Africa, where these IPs were taken by foreign nationals instead of being retained in South Africa to beneficiate the society. We have Mr. McLean here, Mr. Banda with us here, who will take any questions about the Innovation Fund. This slide here just shows you the amount of money invested in the different areas. You see, down agriculture is where I but the highest of them is health, followed by mining and minerals, and then manufacturing there, with ICT not lagging far behind the environment, and then, of course, agriculture, and so on and so forth. The key challenge is coming down to the wire now, wrapping up. We want to redefine the role of the NRF in relationship to all of these entities that exist here, the National Space Agency, the current challenges. We want to review the positioning of selected national research facilities. For example, STANDARD, the Biodiversity and Conservation Cluster. How do we reconcile that within the body of our national facilities we have? The other question is, what other national facilities should actually be declared national facilities before we reach the NRF? We want to influence that kind of thinking here and define the role of the NRF in respect to those things. Implementation of research plans with the national research facilities. We have a workshop coming up sometime in April that will bring together all the national research facilities executives and managers to talk about how we implement the research plans that we put together in the national National Research Facilities Infrastructure Upgrade. As you know, with any infrastructure, that it needs to be refurbished, needs to be maintained from time to time. Most of these are old and dilapidated. You have to only go to the zoo to see what's going on there. There's serious need for infrastructure upgrades in many of our facilities. Well, because of the MPEF limitations, we are finding ourselves having to phase the implementation of the NRF 2015 vision. And we'll see in the next slide how the MPEF has lived up to what we expected it to be. In real terms, the MPEF is really declining. The core allocation we are given is declining when you think about the fact that the inflation rate is running at about 7.58 CPIX, and our core grant has risen by a little, 5 billion, about 6%. In fact, that means it's really decreasing, rather increasing. What is growing very fast here, as you can see, are the contract and green fence funds. So overall, we have a 20% increase. Now that 20% is really explainable by that. And that's nothing, we don't have any control over the green fence funding. But what we are feeling is that the core really be given a bit of a push, because what it does, the implication it has on our ability to actually deal with labor. Labor can't cut their incomes in terms of the CPIX. And if we're given like a 5-6% increase, where are we going to get this money to match what labor expects? And in our case, unlike HSRC and other facilities, we have things to maintain on an ongoing basis. Those animals in the zoo will need to be fed, they need to be watched, and so on. We can't afford to have, a diet for you. So what this means is that we'll have to take money from the maintenance fund to maintain the facilities in order to keep up or match whatever negotiation outcomes are in terms of labor. And that doesn't go well for the infrastructure at the facilities themselves. So this is the problem that we see at the NRF and members of the PCC on science and technology. This is an area we can use some help. With that, I say thank you and for your time. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Prof. And I think it's always a pleasure to listen to you. It was in the same room the last time we met where you mesmerized this committee once more, but particularly your passion for the PhD program. Thank you very much. I'm not going to waste time, but to give members to engage with the information chair. But before I do that, I think I might just introduce our brand new member to this committee, the work of this committee as well. Ms. Lorna Maloney, please welcome.
Increasing this cover.
Okay, let me take the hand. Let me start with Ms. Hensley, Mokel, and Ms. Lemoyne, and that in this order. We'll just take the head.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. I always look forward to this presentation because it is given with passion and great detail, and there's a lot for us to think about in our input in various committees and also in our input when we discuss the budget in the National Service. So thank you. Clearly, a lot of work, a lot of thorough work has gone in, as it always has, every year, in the presentation. Thank you very much. I have just honestly really three very short questions. Are you able to monitor the effectiveness or the impact of the funds that you allocate to these various research projects, in particular the impact they have over time, things don't happen overnight, but over time on the ground, in meeting our, for example, in meeting our national objectives of eradicating poverty, increasing employment, and so on. The second one is, are there any conditions attached to the grant made to students in terms of having to pay back over time, in terms of perhaps having to contract themselves to working in this country for a certain number of years? I have a nephew who received funds from the NRF to do his research. 6 months after getting his PhD, he left the country and he's now in England, and I doubt if he'll ever come back. I hope you're making him pay every cent with interest. I don't know, I haven't asked him. And just then, thirdly, there was an intriguing little afterthought in your 7 investment areas. It actually dislocated your 100% budget. It actually comes to 100.2%. It's a little add-on, which I find interesting. Community engagement research. If you can perhaps just expand a little bit on that and indicate what that is. It sounds quite intriguing. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. You didn't say that next time when you get that page, your face will be there. you made a comment to say, listen,
this
page is reserved for me there. okay. Thank you very much. Let's take the responses on those.
There are 3 questions which Norton is asking at the thank for your kind in terms of our presentation and the work that went into it, and I don't want to personally take credit for it because it's the team that put it together, really. These guys that I work with have been really amazing in terms of supporting the goals of the nation, and when we went around and talked to the university stakeholders, they didn't like what we said at times, but one of the things we told them was that it would be arrogant for people at university to think that they can be pay attention to national priorities in a way that supersedes that of the policy decision makers. And this is not my statement. It's a statement that was made in the Rothschild principle of OECD countries. They were looking at the structuring and the stratification of decision making, that at the top it's the president and the government, at the next level it's the department. And that's where decision making, policy decisions are made. That the people at the bottom who are the implementers cannot know the priorities of the country as well, as intensely as those who are policy decision makers. And that's you. But I can say this to you because I'm sure you'll agree with me that in the contact you have with the constituencies, perhaps you have the pulse closer to where things need to be and you guide us with those. But when you ask us about monitoring effectiveness and efficiency and impact of research in eradicating poverty in other priority areas of the country, yes, we do this. In fact, in the last round, when we presented our results, we were asked the first year I came here the same question by the previous chair. And then for the for presenting the results of our outcome last September, was it September or October? We then brought a supplement along with our results that showed this impact in different areas. In fact, there's nothing we'd love to do more the next time we come to you than to put together a booklet that shows how some of this research, it might not be right where the poverty is, but it goes a long way towards laying the foundation, the grassroots, to be able to attend to issues of poverty. Some of the research we do, for example, in areas that help crops to withstand droughts, we can document that there are researchers who are doing that. The whole grand strategy of global warming and how the impact that it has on communities. We have results that can show how that works, and I'm sure the colleagues can add on to that. I'm interested, Mr. Ansley, about your nephew, because I just heard that we had someone who's overseas in South Africa who applied for funding to another organization as a South African and was awarded that funding. maybe I can get the name of your nephew from you afterwards. But the question of conditions attached, probably the vice president can address that issue. And the question of community, how we plan to implement our strategies in a way that I wanted to see that bullet you are referring to. What page is it? Albert, maybe
Chair, if I may just respond to the two last ones, I've been asked to look at the conditions. The only conditions that we have for students at the moment is essentially students that that fail to complete their degrees at the end. So we do go through a process of trying to retrieve the funds from those students. In reality, though, sometimes more successfully than other times. We've had, you know, you pretty soon, with a few allocations of bursaries, find yourself in a position where the legal costs start exceeding the value of the bursary you're trying to retrieve from a student. And then it becomes a cost-effective exercise. So we do that up to a point where we're not wasting the taxpayers' money in terms of chasing it. Then no conditions attached in terms of leaving the country. What we do, though, is with at the more senior level, when people do get funding, particularly from international institutions and so on, and they go across and do postdocs or PhDs in foreign countries. For instance, if the United States was supporting them to go across and do a PhD, there will be a condition of return attached to that. But there aren't any conditions of people having to stay in the country for NRF grants. I think, although I share the sentiment and I can 100% understand where it comes from, we tend to think here in the NRF not in terms of trying to retain every single individual. You know, people that do go abroad and pick up lots of good experiences, and eventually sometimes they come back only 25 years later, like our CEO, and comes and makes a fundamental contribution to our system. And so we think more in terms of brain circulation in terms of the modern economy rather than brain drain in that regard. So I hope we come back with more experiences. But I understand the sentiment 100%, but we don't have any conditions at the moment. As far as the investment areas are concerned, it's one of the things that that came up in our discussions with our stakeholders about the way forward for the NRF in the strategic planning exercise. And we came to the realization that we're actually spending quite a lot of money, as do many other agencies and the science councils, in the area that we call community engagement. The higher education sector spends a lot of money in the area of community engagement. But the feeling was amongst the community that our understanding of what actually constitutes effective community engagement, in other words, what actually works, is very, very, very thin. So what we try to do with this small investment to start off with, but it will grow over time hopefully, is to start active research using the university communities and the university outreach community engagement exercise to learn about what kinds of community engagement actually have impact. And I think that relates back to the first question in that regard. And this is really what we're trying to learn by virtue of that investment that we're making. To help guide us in the future as to where we should be investing our money as far as the community engagement is concerned.
Just one other little point, Chair. We just returned from the NSF with a bilateral letter led by the DSTDG, Firm Drucker, where we had the United States people aside, outside on this side. Our opposite number, the NSF hammered on this point of community engagement. In fact, they say that when they allocate research money to any project whatsoever, a certain percentage of that should be shown to go to engage the community somehow or other. Mm-hmm. Either by getting youngsters to come and work in your lab and you can show them that we have people in the community coming to do this, or actually helping a community. You may be doing research in theoretical physics that has nothing to do with anything with the community, but part of the requirement is you must show at the end of the day that X percent of your money went towards community engagement somehow. And this is something that we in the NRF are starting to seed with this point two. Perhaps we'll increase that number significantly in the future.
Certainly, Chair, I think the CEO has summarized very well. It really is a plank that in due course must become a central one in the way in which the NRF goes about its business.
Hello, thank you very much. I mean, to the DST, you will recall that we have always been stressing some team effort in preparing for a strategy of this nature. Please just ensure that we take from this, we benchmark what the NRF has for, you see, in terms of what we're looking for. I'm just also expressing appreciation. And also to state to you that we lost out on an opportunity, we're deprived of that opportunity actually to visit some of your facilities and so on and so on. We're still planning to do that. So by the time, we won't wait for you to come here with the booklet, we'll come to you and thank you. So just be rest assured. I've got on my list Mr. Mokel, Mr. Nopolo Vodja, Mr. Blanchet, and Loe Namre Namnyantu. And then in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you once again for a very good presentation. I want to refer specifically to page or slide 7 and slide 30 of your presentation. You talk on page 7 of 1% of global R&D output by 2015. And then on page 30 you say that you want to increase the number of doctoral graduates to 1,800 by 2010, and at the present 2005 level of S&T PhDs is 561 per year, like that on page slide 25. Let's just see I'm trying to see if I understand it. The rest of the committee may understand it, but I'm not sure if I understand it correctly. This 1% of global research and development output, we're not talking about gross national product or research and development. We're talking about all of the research and development work being done in the world. We want to attack that research and development work to be done here. Is that what you're saying?
No, we want to contribute to that research and development as South Africans, because if you have the world community contributing to knowledge, that's the 100%. Some of it comes from the U.S., India, and so on. South African researchers also contribute by way of ISI outputs, patents, and those kinds of things. So we're saying that at this point we're sitting at 0.4, less than 0.4 of that big 100%. We want to grow that by having more journal articles, more patents issued to the point of 1% of global R&D.
And then the second question, Chair. I've looked at the pipeline in particular, the PhD pipeline, and I'm utilizing the technology put at our disposal there. on here is a little Excel program, and I'm punching those figures in here. I've drawn a comparison between all graduates, the top pipeline, slide 25, and the outcomes in the SET sector, and I note the following: that there's a 30% of all senior certificate graduates are S&T qualified. If I can back it by, right? Undergraduates 32.14% is your undergraduates. And so on, and then it goes, and the honors goes to 13% of all honors graduates are S&T graduates,
36% of all master's graduates are SET graduates, and then 46.75% of all graduates are SET graduates, PhD graduates.
Right.
But there's a drop through the pipeline, and I'm saying the drop through the pipeline from in the SET in particular, from your senior certificate with high grade math and science. You then have that drop of 38.5%. Then from undergraduate to honors, you have a drop of almost 80%.
Yes.
And that to me is a key figure here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then from honors to masters, it drops by 9%. And then from honors to PhD, even again a high figure of 80%. Now, if one takes that into account, then in the pipeline, the two alarming figures is the drop from undergraduate to honors level, and then from master's to PhD level. From honors to master's, there seems to be a small percentage drop. What are the reasons for this at that point in the pipeline? See, and I think we need to look at that in particular. Now, there have been some motivation preferred already in the presentation. I accept that, but I'm saying in that point in particular in the pipeline.
Sure, if I could respond, and then Professor Margalisa and perhaps Dr. Fanyastov might like to add. This is exactly the problem, you know, and in fact the honors problem really encapsulates the seriousness of it all. And as you correctly pointed out, in fact, simply by addressing that problem of the pipeline, of a more efficient pipeline, one would be able to achieve much better graduation rates. So it's not even a case of having to go look for greater numbers of undergraduates. Why is that the case? Well, there are various reasons, you know, but if I could answer from the perspective of somebody who's in the university system, it's unfortunately the case, I think, and particularly in sciences and engineering, that the honors degree is perceived to be somewhat elitist qualification. Let's talk about the BSc, where you have a three-year degree and then the one-year honors degree. So the entry into honors programs becomes something of a gateway. If one unpacks this figure, if you go into universities, you will find, say, a graduating class in microbiology of 60-odd students and perhaps 10 or so going into honors, which is absolutely ridiculous, and the universities, I think, or many of them anyway, are addressing this issue. Really, what we want to be seeing, what we should be seeing, is a situation in which, by and large, every competent BSc graduate should be aspiring to go on to an honors degree. And in fact, to think of their tertiary education as comprising at least effectively a four-year qualification. That is what engineering is anyway. Business sciences, they are four-year qualifications. So, in a sense, I'm pointing fingers at the universities. I'm pointing fingers at myself in particular, but really the job of the NRF, I think, is one of engaging actively with the university sector to unblock that major obstacle there.
Any other questions to add?
If I may, Chair, thank you for the opportunity. I agree 100% with the assessment from the Chair of the Board that the honours is critical. It is the choke point in our system, essentially, that determines what happens down the line. The slight difference between masters and PhD, you'll see that there's a little note included there that says including coursework masters. So there are many students that actually register for coursework masters, but if you look at the students that are actually involved in research-based master's degrees, the difference between the MSc and the PhD is not as dramatic as it appears from the figures that we have in front of us there. So that partially explains that particular choke point. But the honors one is critical. And I think we need to have a national engagement and discussion about this issue. We we think at the NRF that we need to think, look at our degree structures, the way they're offered at the moment. At the moment, we have three selection points. After the bachelor's degree, for the honors, after the honors for the master's, after the master's for the PhD. And if you compare that with the American system, essentially they'll have one selection point in their system. They'll have a four-year bachelor's degree, which will include the honors, essentially. But that means we'll have to restructure the way our honors is presented, because we'll have to be dealing with slightly larger classes and so on. But I think we need to have that discussion. Is that not in our interest to think along those lines? And then also to think along the lines of possibly having what we would call a graduate program. In other words, after you've gone through the four-year graduate degree, you then get selected into a graduate program, and the output of the graduate program should be the PhD. Unless people don't make it through the system and they fall out for reasons maybe halfway through the system with a lesser qualification, which we can then call a master's. But I think by opening up the selection points in the system and going towards a system which is actually closer aligned with what they're doing in Europe and the USA at the moment in any case, we can actually change the system in a way that actually serves our purpose. What we can see from these figures, and this is what I keep stressing to the higher education sector when we have these discussions with them, is what we're doing at the moment is not working. Anybody can see that. So we can't stay with the status quo and say that that's good enough and we simply have to do it better. We have to do something differently in our system. So that's just for consideration, Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mokot, it looks like you still want to...
Just a follow-up based on this particular bottleneck. I think the presenters have made it clear to us, Chair, that on page 22, how they sort of want to mitigate this situation and resolve it to some extent with the human capital development students at bursary value being assigned that $30 million additional investment for 2008. Now, this is some sort of incentive. It's a carrot being dangled by the NRF. But it would be interesting, Chair, to see those graduates that are already employed, that don't feel themselves not being part of lifelong learning necessarily in the workplace. They don't necessarily see themselves going to a higher level. And I'm wondering, Chair, that there might not be a solution to be found in the way we manage our CETAs and the contribution that CETAs could make in progressing them through the pipeline within a particular sector, within a particular company context.
Thank you very much. I think it's a useful input for us to look into. And I see a lot of collaboration with the Department of Education here, and with industry in particular. The question of staff development becomes also very key. So that, let's see what you've got from me, Professor, and the NRF. There's funds there, the lodge, you see, because we try to encourage our kids also to say, listen, you go back to school now. This whole story of everybody wanting a pound in their pocket must stand. Let's go for a knowledge-based economy and study. Daniel Nopolofoto, what do you say?
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for the wonderful presentation. I've got three areas that I would want to get your views on. The first area relates to research that has not as yet been turned into practical reality, which are there in universities. You go and find good things. Sometimes when you study, you are also referred to those good things. But it ends just there. And what I want to know is whether there are any efforts to make sure that if a research is can be practicalized, to assist the researcher to practicalize it there and there at the university level, to make sure that the researcher can see that there are benefits, right? And that might actually incentivize the researcher to go further and further. So there must be benefits to the country and also benefits to the researcher. That's what I want just to get your views. Because in the past, research used to be done and no benefits to the researcher, but benefits to even other people other than the country itself. Then my second area is of the indigenous knowledge system as a strategic knowledge field. I'm very excited about that when I checked the and found that you want to make it a knowledge field. Now, I want to know whether you are going to be able to systematize that knowledge, because it was knowledge by itself. If it's not systematized, nobody else will learn about it. And so we will continue to talk about indigenous knowledge system, indigenous knowledge evidence there. So we need to find a strategy to systematize it, so that my child who is born 2020 might be able to go to school and read and say, this is indigenous knowledge system of this data. I can also use it to do ABC. That's my second area of concern. Now, the other one is really just a comment over a matter which I believe is not only for the NRF. It's for all of us. It is this area of funding, and at the end of that, what do you call it? This chup. At the end of that pipeline, you produce 100 PhDs, and you end up with one PhD, which is circulating ecosystem. And the other PhDs have gone because of benefits that they have been offered. And so I get worried around that. So we need to find a way, really, because we can fund here as you are proposing, but at the end of it, they go to Australia because offers are made, as you said quite rightly. The Australian offered a person to cater for the wife, which we didn't really think and attach value, and I think we should have realized that to separate a wife from it won't be helpful. But my point, just to finish, my point is that we need to find a strategy to control the movement out of our country of those that we have actually funded. The point has been made even in another committee about the nurses. Right? We trained a lot of good nurses and midwives, and they are all in Britain and in the Middle East. And now we have a shortage. So that's the thank you. Thank you very much.
Hello. What I like about the input is your forward planning. Your 2020, the child. Looking for it. That's good. Shall we take some responses on all these other serious matters?
Well, I'd like to start with the last one, if I may. The last one of the retention of PhDs, I think it's that's a crucial one. And but like the Vice President said earlier on, in the knowledge economy, we really talk about brain circulation more than brain drain as such. But I think, speaking about South Africans, you saw the statistic that said the program that myself and Honorable Mianlu and others went overseas on. South Africans are very unique in the sense of the pride they have of their on their country. I want to say even those that choose to leave, they don't leave voluntarily. It's not like those nurses, they don't prefer to be in England.
Yeah.
For
yes.
some
yeah.
somehow
yes.
there's something we're
yes.
not doing
yes.
right
yes.
here by nurses.
Yes. Yes.
There's something we're not doing right
yes.
by PhDs
yes.
at universities.
Yes.
I think that the way that universities compensate and attract
sure.
PhD people here is a shame. I can talk about my own field in the business management area. What they've done in the United States is free that market to market influence. For example, if somebody can be offered a job on Wall Street at a high salary, the university will go a long way towards matching that. Along the lines, you see this slide, what we're trying to do with this slide. We're trying to put the degree offers that, you know, the scholarship given to students to be aligned with the marketplace. If the market says we'll give you 60,000 to start you off when you have a bachelor, and we're saying we'll give you 40,000 to do an honors, we're being competitive.
Yep.
I think that the university system here, to me, there's a distortion that's going on here. Where to start correcting it, I don't know. But the brain drain you see with nurses is just an example, I think, of why people leave South Africa. They leave South Africa, of course, for other reasons, such as the violence problem that you have in this country, but also the level of compensation that they are likely to get elsewhere. I think until and unless we look at the whole way we allocate rewards and remuneration in the country, will go to a long way towards offsetting that drain that you see going abroad. As far as we in the NRF are concerned, in the debate that we're doing, we're trying to up those figures, and we will engage the university communities to make it attractive for the youngsters to stay at the universities once they graduate, because the obligation is there. There are many others who are younger want to take over from them. But we want to make it in such a way that it's not tantamount to economic suicide, because remember, a lot of these people are faced with two options. They have family. They have struggled all the way, and now they get their PhD. They are at a crossroads. Mm. Should I go and take this six-figure salary in a private company that operates in Nairobi and thereby be able to support my extended family here at home? Or should I stay here and get the little bit that I'm getting, and then the perpetuation of that suffering and struggling at home continues? And a lot of times people will choose the latter. That makes that life a little bit easier for them, the former, the one before. But that's my answer to that. On the question of indigenous knowledge system as a knowledge field that we want to develop, this is a concept, I guess, the Vice President can talk a little bit more on that indigenous knowledge system, because it resides in his area. But and then perhaps Mr. Sibanda can also talk about the other one of research turned into reality at universities, because those are two very crucial issues, areas that we play in at the NRF. But with the emerging TIA, we think that first question you asked will be addressed quite a bit in terms of taking those research efforts and turning them into reality. But regardless of TIA, at the NRF, when the Innovation Fund was brought to the NRF, I understand, back at the turn of the century, one of the goals was for the Innovation Fund to have somebody there whose job was to scour the knowledge fields that are being generated, or the knowledge outputs coming from the researchers of the form that you're describing, of knowledge that's there but it's not been turned into reality that would beneficiate the researcher and the society. That person was charged with the responsibility of singling out and scoping those research projects and then bringing them to the attention of management in terms of how it can be helped and catalyzed to get to that next level that you're talking about. Unfortunately, that was not really played out. It didn't work out the way, because the innovation grew in different ways, and as Mr. Sibanda perhaps can explain what they decided to do. But there are efforts now in place to do that. And once TIA has taken off, and Albert will probably elaborate more on this, we plan within the NRF to continue in that field you're describing, that area of the gray area of research that's still blue skies and green fields that can be turned into beneficiating society in a way that resides still at the lab, but has a little bit of a benefit to the researcher and to the society as a whole. I think the two gentlemen I've mentioned perhaps can chip in here and help, please.
Thank you.
Chair, I'd like to add to what Professor Maralisa has said, and I think what the Innovation Fund has been doing is we set up a program called the Near Market Opportunity Program to really look at the research projects which are being done under the NRF to try to move some of those into the more applied research. And tied up with that, there's other instruments that we set up. We are also in the process of setting up technology transfer offices at various universities to put capacity in place to assist the researchers in analyzing their research to be able to find out what outputs could be commercialized and what outputs could be translated to the benefit of society. Together with that, there is a patent incentive fund that we set up in 2004 to provide monetary incentives to researchers at universities to basically patent they research, the result of their research, with the hope that when the researchers now undertake the research, they will be not focused only on curiosity-driven research, but there will be an inquiry in terms of what part of this curiosity-driven research can be used in the marketplace, and the program seems to be going quite well at the moment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair, just about the question of IKS, if I may respond to Honourable Member. As you know, there was an IKS initiative a few years ago that I think the overall impression, both from our partners at the Department of Science and Technology as well as the NRF, was that it was unsatisfactory. It wasn't really delivering what we wanted out of the system. Essentially, what happened is that it landed up funding researchers in the system to systemize the knowledge that we have available in the traditional communities. The participation of the traditional communities and the practitioners in IKS in particular was very, very low in that program. What we've done is we sat down with DST, we've revamped and rethought the whole program. And essentially, this is what the outcome of that process. Now, first of all, the Indigenous Knowledge System program will require partnership between the research community and the practitioners. In other words, as part of the proposal, it's got to be written in there. Who's going to be participating? What are their contributions to what's going to be put on the table? And how is it going to benefit the various parties in terms of what they're trying to achieve? So by going into a joint collaborative effort, we hope we can systemize the IKS in a more systematic way than we have in the past. It's being run slightly different from a traditional research program. It's not just research orientated. It's about documenting and recording exactly what kind of Indigenous knowledge is available in the system. It's about capturing that knowledge and making it available into, if we can, potential commercial or potential beneficiation outcomes at the end of the day. I think it's but much more directed. It's much more targeted towards I think the original intention was when the people established the IKS system. And I hope in a few years' time we'll be able to report on some really significant successes in that regard.
I don't know, Chair, if I can just add the example, perhaps, to put meat into what we're talking about. The example of the Kelika. I don't know if you know that example of the Kelika. Kelika is a drink. It's an alcoholic beverage that when we grew up in the townships, people used to brew on their own. They would throw all sorts of things, including old shoes and socks and drinking water in there. And that thing was really very, very powerful. It would knock you down if you drank enough of it. But this was done, there's a fascinating story that came out of the University of Rome, where a researcher there had a jar of honey that was full of honey, but it was being drawn down every time, and he didn't know who was using this honey until he set the trap one day and found out one of the cleaners in the lab was actually coming to steal that honey and taking it to the township in Grahamstown. Instead of punishing this guy, the researcher said, "Can you tell me what you do with this honey?" And so the guy took him to the township and showed him that it's a critical ingredient of chili. That's right. So the researcher, instead of fighting with this guy, said, "Tell me how this chili is brewed." And the researcher, was able to break down the chemical composition of this and the mixtures and the procedures and so on. And out of that came this chili drink. It's now being commercialized and it's being manufactured in Grahamstown, beneficiating society there. The people who started, out of which this came, get jobs, and the researcher gets a patent out of that. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's sold, not here in South Africa, it's sold outside of South Africa, this clinic. I don't know if any of you know about it, but for us, this is an example of what we mean by this Indigenous knowledge. Yeah. There's several things. These are things that Indigenous people have used throughout the time to remediate themselves, So why not have partnerships with communities and researchers so that both of them benefit out of this? At the same time, we'll retain the IP in the country here, IPR.
That's something we must also think about. Not all thieves must go to jail. Some of them must follow and see the venue.
Mr. Chairman, we as a committee must realize we're busy with an oversight function. And if we hand out money from the taxpayer to any organization, that fund, that money must be well spent. And I'm upset because the questions my colleague, Mr. Ainsley, has asked, has been asked by myself before, and every time we get the same answer. Let me say to the NRF, I am very upset with what I hear about how the fund is being used. I come from a town called Boxburg, and it's had a student fund since 1945. It's a turnover fund. Everybody who benefits from that fund to go and study must pay back that money. And that fund has grown enormously. Because next year, to help a student to study, it's going to cost more. And the taxpayer's got to pay that. And therefore, you must use that fund beneficially from that person who has benefited from the fund. It must come back into your fund, and you must grow your fund. Because the next set of students you want to train or become PhD, it's going to become more expensive for you to do that. And we cannot just use taxpayers' funds and hand it out and then find that those agencies using it are saying, no, well, it becomes part of the world brain drain. It's a part of the fund that just gets circulated. We're not here to fund the world. We want to see South Africans benefit from it. Let me tell you, the old apprentice system was an ideal system to get somebody trained to become a craftsman. It took you 5 years to become a tradesman. But the first 3 years, you were trained how to do the job. The next 2 years, you were paid low by that company, a low wage. You were paid a fourth and a fifth year apprentice fee. But you've already been a tradesman. You were doing a good job. So you were, in fact, paying the company back for training you. And that's what we do with the taxpayers' money. We hand them funds to train people or to get people an education. If they didn't want to leave this country, they pay it back. In Boxburg, that fund, you've got to pay it back. Whether you go and study to become a doctor, an engineer, or an accountant, or whatever, you pay it back to the Boxburg Bursary Fund. And that fund has been growing since 1945. So I'm surprised that you think that government's funds can just be spent and, well, next year we'll ask for more. Shouldn't be like that, Mr. Chairman. Shouldn't be like that. Let me show you what I also find disturbing. Looking at page number 38, engineering is the least investment you've made, the lowest one. Chemical, there's nothing in chemical, but there's two chemicals. One shows a bar and the other one shows nothing. But engineering is the lowest. And then if you look at energy, and in recent months we've had a major energy crisis in this country. We're going to be faced with that crisis for the next 10 years. And we don't seem to be spending anything on energy. Surely there must be some research done on energy and how we can use something more, because Eskom is in a crisis. Biofuels we need to know more about. Sasol has been doing a good job. The pebble-bed modular reactor is on its way. But we don't hear from you spending money on the energy field. And that's what I would like to know as a member of this committee. What are you spending in face of the crisis that we're facing in this country as far as energy is concerned? Mr. Chairman, I've made a note here. My colleague asked the question first, but whilst we were listening to you, I made these notes. What about innovations to generate electricity with old and existing technology? When we have spent money to train PhDs, they leave the country. Do we lose PhDs from page 22? Yes. You told us we are losing.
but we're not worried about losing them. We've trained them, and they go and work for somebody else. It shouldn't be allowed. I'm not in favor of spending the taxpayers' money in that way. What about the replacement of migrating knowledge? Because we find that even in the local governments, we have crisis in local government because of the infrastructure going into a defect. It's because of migrating knowledge. We bring new knowledge in there. They're not people with PhDs. They are people who are supposed to be trained with more technology to fix up the roads, to fix up the water, the sanitation systems, etc., or to keep them maintained. But we don't have anything. So what is the NRF doing to ensure that we retain that kind of a knowledge in local governments? We cannot just be looking at PhDs all our life. We are losing a vast number of technologists at local government level, at agricultural level. And that's where we should be putting in these funds. I hate to hear that we are putting it in a PhD and he leaves the country. He's going to leave the country because he's going to get better offers in Australia. He's going to get better offers in the United States and in Europe. But that's not our job to train Europe and Australia's PhDs. And we're going to do it. Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of these pages that I've marked like that, but I'm upset to year after year hear this, that we are training the PhDs. And I've always been saying our biggest loss and our biggest job should be to train the people after they've left school. And that's where the NRF must help us to see what we can do with those funds to train that people. There are many more people than the figures you've shown us here on the number of PhDs. I'm not so concerned about the PhDs than what I'm concerned about the vast number of matriculants every year roaming our streets for the next 3-4 years after they've left school. I think the NRF has got a job to do to look what's happening. Mr. Chairman, maybe there's some answers for what I'm saying, but let's bring some sanity back into the committee.
I'll make a start.
I'll
make a start, Chair. My colleagues will assist me. Mr. Blanchet, yes, you've stated the point very well, and not for the first time, and with some justification. Let me just comment first on your remarks about the apprentice system in particular, but let me broaden this a little. Of course, you're absolutely right. This country does not need only PhDs. What we need is the whole spectrum of qualified people, from apprentices to technicians to professionals and everything in between. And I would agree with you. In order to build infrastructure, one needs architects, engineers, and the like. But you need technicians. You need artisans as well. It's in my opinion, it's an issue. It's a problem which we are all facing, including the Department of Education. You know, I'll give you an example. I spend a lot of time in Germany in the course of my research work, and I'm always struck by by one aspect of the system there. They have universities, which are like our universities, and they have technical universities as well. And they also have what are called Fachhochschule, which are, I'm not sure about what the appropriate translation is, but they are essentially vocational tertiary institutions that, by and large, turn out technicians, highly qualified technicians, graduates, who are in much demand, are highly respected, and are well paid. And the system works extremely well. So instead of it being seen as some sort of second prize, places at the Fachhochschule are sought after. You go there because you want to be a technician, and you will end up operating very sophisticated equipment, designing and the like. What we need is everything across that spectrum. I absolutely agree with you. But let us not throw the baby out with the bathwater. We do need the PhDs. We cannot have them exclusively. I'm coming to that in a moment. Let's just talk about the spectrum. You know, we have gaps all along the way. We talked earlier in relation to Mr. Walker's question about this precipitous drop at the honors level. One needs people literally at every level in order to have a fully functioning knowledge economy and economy, more broadly speaking. Now, to come to the second point, I do think with respect that it is overstating the case to say that we are trading PhDs and they're all leaving the country. Some of them do. Many of them do remain. Many of our graduates and our master's graduates do remain. The issue for us is the following, and just by the way, just as an aside, again, this is an issue that goes way beyond the NRF and science and technology. One's simply got to look at the numbers of medical doctors who leave, many immediately following graduation. Yeah, it's a pervasive problem. But instead of, you know, whinging about it all, I think we have some lessons that we can learn from countries like China and India. It used to be the case that Indian graduates would go to the US, to Britain, to go and do their PhDs. The vast majority, 90%, would go abroad to do their PhDs. Hardly any would return because of the opportunities in those countries. The same thing with China. What is happening now, as those countries' economies take off in the way that they are doing, it is being realized that the only way in which those economies will continue to grow is if they, like ourselves, have sufficient numbers of qualified people at all levels, including PhDs. Therefore, they've got to get their graduates back. And they are succeeding. They are succeeding, despite the fact that an Indian PhD graduate working in Delhi, say, will earn a fraction of what he or she will earn in the US. Why are they succeeding? Because they are creating the opportunities. And this is what we have to do. But still, I would contest the fact that all our PhD graduates are leaving. Many of them are staying. And also, Dr. Nyarsfeld, I think, was quite right to talk about, I forget his words, but you know, we are part of a global knowledge system. And it is good for our people to go abroad and to, you know, not to become inbred, and for many of them to come back. And it is good for researchers from other parts of the world to come here and to share their knowledge with us. We have many, many graduate students from other parts of Africa, for example, who in the past would look to the old colonial powers, whether Britain or France, to go to study and work. Many of them are coming to South Africa. It's causing brain drain issues for those countries as well. But there is this kind of circulation which I think we must also promote. So I haven't perhaps covered everything, but I'll leave my colleagues to continue.
No, Chair, with your permission, Chair, I just wanted to endorse the last point that Professor Reddy just made. The point of, I think, Mr. Clancher was not only just talking about PhD leaving. Perhaps you are referring more to the program that we send our students to go and study abroad. I just wanted to address that particular one. Is that one of the reasons Minister Mangena is supporting this program, to get at least one-third of these people who are taking on to be sent abroad on South African assisted scholarship. Most of them will get scholarships from those universities that are allocated for South Africa. And right now we're hearing universities have set aside money for South African students, but there are no takers. Rutgers had 3 scholarships for doctorate in astronomy, the very field we are competing with Australia against, and then we don't have any takers.
So to facilitate that process is important. But I think it's important, and it ties also with the knowledge that, you know, the question you asked, Mr. Neforoforte, is that for a long time, South African students, especially from historically disadvantaged communities, have not been given the choices, have been made to understand that they're inferior. In fact, indeed, the problem that Mr. Morkel was highlighting of the drop from bachelor's to honors is predicated on that. The decision makers at universities, even today, are driven by that mentality. And it is here where sending our people abroad makes a big transformation. You take a graduate from who's born and bred and raised throughout and get his PhD here in South Africa and put him against someone who has spent time either doing postdoc or doing some work overseas and experienced life overseas, you'll see a marked difference in the lack of tolerance with the foot dragging that's going on in the country in terms of transforming it. I mean, all those people I put up over there went and studied abroad. One by one, they came back. And where they are now, they're very influential in a way that shakes and moves the whole system in a very, very rapid way compared to people who would have been brought here. When I worked for Lima Brothers, I was given a promotion to go and run that factory in Boxford as the soap factory manager there. I had trepidation because I'd never been abroad. They refused to send me to support Sunlight in England to be trained as a factory manager. Here I am to run a factory. This happened at the aftermath of that debate about desegregating the public bus, the swimming pool system of Boxford, where the people in Boxford voted against it. I don't know if you remember that, Mr. Blind.
I was in the lead.
Not integration.
To break down the fences.
Yeah, see, that was the problem. I was born and raised in Benoni.
Hold on.
Madam, say,
No. When you say speak, all of you keep quiet now.
Thank you.
Okay, Professor, continue. You're exciting, Mr. Banshee. The Boxburg debates are very heated.
We can go to the fund in Boxburg and look at the social economic construction of that fund and how it's being operated. In fact, I was thinking maybe the NRF should, with your help, hook up with the people in Boxburg
and see
who gets into that money. And how it gets appropriated, who beneficiates from it, how we can learn from the way that it's being run in a way that will help us do some of the things we want to do for South African system. But we are not really here, and Professor Nyalso and Dr. Professor Reddy have talked to this. We're not here to waste South African taxpayers' money. We're here to invest South African taxpayers' money. And the way you do it is not by looking at short-term benefits. We want people to be back here right now and today. We are looking at the long-term so that the generations to come will benefit in an irreversible way. Because right now, all the things that we're doing here in the system are reversible. You only have to think about the recent events that you asked us to talk about today that have happened in the landscape here in South Africa. There is a need for us to radically change the system. And we're saying that these programs that we're talking about will radically change the system. Perhaps the beneficiation will not be seen in our own lifetime. But I think that for policy decision makers, it's important for us when we talk strategy to think about the long term. Mr. Neforoforte, I think you're the one who talked about 2020, when your child is 2020.
Yeah.
But I wonder if that child will be yours or somebody else. But thank you.
Dr. Fadiasa, just before you go on, I think the point is made. We can't go on the same old way of saying.
No.
Some PhDs might not even take that offer if you say we're going to retain you here.
Yeah.
You see, so I think the point is made, but let's balance it with also the issue that Mr. Blanchet is saying, to say that there must be checks and balances in the system. Doctor, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I want to just provide a little bit of information that may resolve some of the questions the Honourable Blanchet has asked us. In terms of the human migration issue, because it's obviously something we have to deal with in this country from a number of sectors, it's not just I would like to just bring to attention of the PPC
a number of reports that were both, all three published in 2007, towards the end of 2007. One by the United Kingdom government, one by the National Academy of Sciences in the USA, and one by the National Science Foundation in Canada. All three of them spoke to one problem. How are they going to, as a nation state, retain their global competitiveness over the next 50 years? And all three of those reports identified the development of human capital as the most fundamental critical investment they have to make in order to retain their global competitiveness. We are launching together with ASEF a study that we hope to publish early next year to look at what are the critical things we have to do to look at those issues, and collaboration with our colleagues at DST and a number of other members. The issue of the global hunt for talent is primary in all these reports. What are the mechanisms that they're putting in place that will allow them to retain the best talent in the system? What are the mechanisms they're putting in place to draw on the best talent in the world from wherever it may come? And that includes very, very aggressive and very, very targeted immigration policies, particularly of people that are PhDs in the system, postdocs in the system. How are they going to get the best people in the world to function in the economies over the next 50 years? If we're thinking about South Africa as a knowledge economy is going to be competitive over the next 50 years, we have to set our sights at functioning in an environment in which there is a global hunt for talent on the go. And we have to ask ourselves, how are we going to compete and function in that environment? I don't think, and we have to look, and this is going to be the reality that we have to deal with as a country. Either you will function in that global economy on a competitive basis, or you will lose out. And I think this is the grand challenge, if you like, that we face as a society. And we really need to take a long-term vision about this. I think we have to be aggressive about it. I think I take the point from the Honourable Blanchet that this is not something that can be done in isolation. We have to think about the total system and how we're going to function in that system. Just about some more the questions about energy. I take the point that the reports don't speak directly to the research projects and so on that's around energy. The impact reports that we brought along in September had a significant section on our investments in the area of biofuels and the ongoing investments in that area. We did talk about a national facility. We spoke about the PBMR. You know, the PBMR is based on expertise in nuclear sciences. Every single one of those scientists that are trained in the area of nuclear sciences are trained through Temba Labs. That's where you get the people that are taken into the job by the PBMR. So we are making contributions. They're not explicit in this report, because this is looking at the future, but in our annual report at the end of the year, certainly those issues will be demonstrated quite clearly. And then I think from the Innovation Fund perspective, I'm going to ask McLean to just tell you about one of the very exciting investments that they've made in the area of solar energy, because I think he'll be able to give you much more background about that area.
Thank you, Chair. I think if one looked at the graph that Mr. Blanchet has referred to, in terms of engineering, there are engineering components embedded in mining, minerals, and manufacturing. I think it's really a classification in terms of what the core strength has been. But also the mechanism that the Innovation Fund runs is an open call system, which means that we, in essence, accept applications from universities and science councils and small businesses. But what we did, what we started to do is run also a number of closed calls. And last year, the number of closed calls that we ran resulted in a number of focus areas. The one focus area was minerals and beneficiation, and tied up to that is beneficiation of silica to be able to provide more outputs in terms of photovoltaics. And you see that in terms, I think, in page 24 of the report that we have from the Innovation Fund, there are two silicon-based projects which we actually currently finalizing for funding, and those are aimed at addressing the energy issues. There's also the biofuels portfolio that is also growing, again, to address the issues of energy. And what Albert has referred to is two technologies that we funded, one at the University of Johannesburg, which I believe has been discussed before at this particular committee. Although that technology has been now commercialized in Germany, it is coming to South Africa to be commercialized in South Africa. In South Africa. The decision for it to be commercialized in Germany by the consortium at the time was really based on the incentives that the German government were providing for the technology to be commercialized in Germany. And again, I think there's a lesson there for us to be able to provide incentives for the technologies that are developed in South Africa to be first commercialized in South Africa. We're also funding a technology at the University of Cape Town, again aimed at developing thin film photovoltaics, where you can be able to print almost on paper photovoltaic technology, again to address the energy needs. There's a technology that we funded, we started funding last year at the University of Western Cape, which is solid polymer electrolyzer. Again, it's aimed at addressing, you know, the energy needs. Again, there is the technology which I think is quite exciting, and a lot will come out in the near future on developing a South African electric vehicle. Now, one can say, well, how can you develop an electric vehicle when we have an energy crisis? But the whole technology is really based on the battery. And the battery technology, and that to be an efficient technology, again, to address some of the energy crisis that, you know, we face, you know, as a country. So there is a lot, and I think in the next reports and the briefings, the Innovation Fund can be able to take the portfolio committee through some of the portfolios.
Exciting stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, the
battery
is a very important one.
Yes, a very important
one.
You
charge
it at night,
like. Charge it by solar. And yeah, you don't need to worry about that.
No, thank you very much. I've got three more honorable members who want to engage. And please rest assured that all the our guests who came here have been quiet throughout. I'm going to give each one of them a minute to say something before they leave. And then we'll take us to after 12. And I'm going to start with, later on, Dr. Daisy Selematsema, and go that whole route according to my list here. So if you think that you go out scot-free without hearing your voice, you're not winning. Bamyan.
Mine is okay.
Use your mask and voice.
You can use his straight away voice.
Load sharing. Thank you very much, Chair. And firstly, I wish to commend NRF for the presentation. You know, it always generates a lot of thinking around the research and the core mandate that has been given to NRF. And I think we must not lose sight of the fact that the core mandate of NRF is research.
And therefore,
issues of master promotion of masters, PhDs, that's where they belong.
Yeah.
They don't belong anywhere, but they belong right there. We can think of other things, but when we speak research, that's their take. Because when we don't have researchers anymore, we'll come back to them and say, but where are the researchers? What are you doing? Because this is the mandate we have given. So then the counter-argument always actually reminds one of what Seth Wood said. Why give a black person mathematics? What is he going to do? By the same token, then what can I do? What gives South African PhDs? What are they going to do with PhDs and this kind of thing? So we need to balance the scale very carefully without losing sight of the fact that research belongs with NRF, you know, and nowhere else. Having said that, Chair, I wonder if NRF really discriminates between, you know, in the consideration of PhDs. Between international and national students. You see, there's always this temptation with supervisors at universities, and I was always tempted myself when I was there. International students coming in, they have writing skills, communication skills, and those kinds of things. and say, but if I can get that student, although he's an international student, then it's going to boost my profile as well. So, you know, it's always tempting to say, well, let me recommend the student. Sometimes at the expense of the national, you know, interest. I wonder how NRF deals with those kinds of things, so that one day we don't wake up only to find that all the PhDs that we have been producing were international students and they are all gone. I know with foreign universities sometimes when you study abroad, tuition is three times. You pay three times tuition. Sometimes they have to negotiate those kinds of things. There was a debate very early in 1990 when this government was still new, I think 1994, whether the, you know, candidates or students coming from Africa should be, you know, treated the same, you know, charge them three times. And the argument, the counter-argument was, but you can't do that because these people, you know, helped, you know, during the struggle and those kinds of things. So I don't know how far that debate has gone now, but it might be very interesting, you know, perhaps, debate, perhaps response from the NRF as well. When it comes to the issues of educational research, you see, you can't think of the national system of innovation in this country without actually also touching on education issues. Now, education will always tell you that 80% of the budget goes towards teacher salaries and only 20% goes towards infrastructure development and that kind of thing. So that is why, therefore, when you tell them that we need, for instance, language laboratories, especially in the rural areas, to help, you know, learners, because the medium of instruction is English, improve their English, and also you need also computer laboratories. They will say there is no money. So I wonder now, with NRF perhaps in the future, if it's not happening at the moment, whether with the education and outreach program, that is a possibility to roll out those kinds of laboratories in rural areas to help with the situation. Because I always believe that if you are really serious about research, you can't start it late at master's and then PhDs. It must start very early. You develop the language efficiency, because when you do your research, you use language as a tool. Your thinking, your giving of evidence, like the NRF is doing, everything, the debate that they present here is always, you know, backed up by, you know, evidence and the challenges, you know, when they present the challenges that the country is faced with. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you,
Bob.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much, Chair, and I want to thank the Honourable Miandu for the questions that he has raised. The causes to, well, first of all, they remind us who the NRF is. In fact, I always like to start the presentation of the NRF by reminding people that the name is National Research Foundation. So we're really at the foundation of research here. And I think in that sense, you can think about the team of soccer players. There's the center half, there's the back, there's the left wing and the right wing. Perhaps we occupy that position, and that's the contribution we made to the nation. Assuming that the nation feels it's necessary for us to play in that field of research led by PhDs. The next question, and I thank you for that, Valmyandu, because that's an important aspect to bear in mind. It ties also with the last point you mentioned, and I'm going to share with you what we just heard, how the NSF operates in that way, which the NRF at this point doesn't do. And I think that it's important the NRF considers going upstream in the way that you're talking about, because researchers are not born at the honors level. they are born way earlier, but the problem is we're not going upstream as high as we should. Let me also talk about the question of, and my observations about this discrimination between national students and international students. By relating your story, we had a delegation from Zimbabwe that came here just 2 weeks ago. And I was talking to them about the position and the structures of the NRF, who occupies what. And they replied in a very shocked way, oh, so in these foundations we have non-South African nationals occupying high positions. You're opening up to that, eh? I said, why is that a shock? In some of our countries, that's that's not done, you know.
And those of us who went to an exile will remember that some of our colleagues were kept in camp, actually, in these countries, instead of being integrated to occupy senior positions. But it's a function of us being part of SADC, I guess, and of NEPAD, and so we're really opening up to Africa in a way that was not the case in other nations. Which brings us to the question of the preference for national, for international versus national students. Just to mention one program, AIMS. I was in Stellenbosch the other day and was introduced to the people of AIMS. You know, this is the Africa Institute for Mathematics and Science. And I noticed that the composition of the students in that program, which is intended to placate the problems of mathematics at an intermediate level so that they can play much more seriously at the higher level, is done. There's money invested there. All the students in that program, I'm subject to correction, maybe one or two, one was an exception. All of them were non-South African Africans in that whole entire program. And when you ask, I guess there are some, you know, entry qualification test for you to enter. And if you tested a person from Kubuletu or from Kwamashu and all that, they'll be weak in mathematics because there's lack of teachers in that area, in that subject area around the country. And then comparing our students with the cream of some of the overseas crop coming here puts them in a terrible disadvantage. So if you put tests, they're going to flunk those tests. And my, just thinking aloud, and I've shared this thought with my colleagues at the NRF, is that if we're trying to intervene in the system of South Africa that's impoverished in the way it has been over the history, we need to lower the boundary, the barrier, or the entry barriers into those particular interventions so that people can be allowed in. And if some of the people that come from abroad, you know, are way over that band, then they don't need this intervention. Otherwise, we're putting the resources of the country to intervene in areas that our country doesn't have a need in. And we're missing out those people in those intervention areas that are needed to help the country go forward. And the same, I think, Professor Reddy and Professor Van Jaarsveld, who've worked as deans at universities, can answer about the question of the preference at the graduate level for people who have degrees from other African countries. I'll give you one more example, and there's a number of these that come to my attention. We are trying to drum up support for the Square Kilometer Array by training radio astronomers in the country. This is people with bachelor's in computer science, computer engineering, and in physics and so on. The special requests that come for people to make a special appeal for, oh, we have 15 now, there's a 16th one, he comes from Kenya. Can we really get him because I'm supervising him here at the University of Cape Town? And I'm saying to myself, we complain, we want to see people from you know, disadvantaged communities in South Africa. But when we get one breakthrough like this, it must be from outside of Africa for good reasons. I mean, researchers have very good ties and they create a good relationship with some of the students coming from abroad who are brothers. But I'm asking, why couldn't they find this person from, say, Soshanguve or some other place like that, that they can make a pitch for us to include that person in there? And the same thing has happened just recently in a program calculated to help matrix or people who have the undergraduate degree to get into this accelerated program that will lead to radio astronomy. Once again, there's 15 allocated. One is from a different country, and I asked openly at the question in front of the DG and others. Do we have a policy in this country whereby money that is collected from South African taxpayers is restricted in the way that in the United States they do? Honorable Nyandu, you know, if you want as an undergrad in America, there's no way they'll give you a scholarship that comes from government money. No way. There are strict conditions. Those government monies are meant for nationals. And then when you go to graduate, PhD and so on, then there are flexibilities because you work and earn that money. In South Africa, I don't know if we have foreign policies that cover these areas. But there's a serious gap there that you have identified and I've seen. The question of outreach programs and research capacity creation, the upstream, just quickly, what they do in the NSF is to have young researchers at the first year level, second year level, being paired with funded researchers to work in their labs either in the summer or the winter. So that this youngster who just graduated with matric comes and works in a lab, and out of that comes a research paper, or some presentation and can see that I'm part of that research, so I can do it. And then at that point, the incentive is created. But as you quite rightly also pointed out, we play in the area of honors and masters by design. I don't know if we should now, based on what Mr. Bunch has also said, if we should not now as an NRF look at, going more upstream as far as our intervention, to the metrics that you talked about, to the in a research way, rather than just telling them about science. That's the time has come to consider that option.
Thank you very much. We're running into injury time. Boss Lau. Doctor, let me suppress you for now, so that I give these two honorable members a chance to say something. Hey, why did you take the one so far?
There's no...
No, it's the easiest
technology
one.
Technology is the receiving.
That's the nearest one.
Oh, okay.
Technology is receiving.
Thanks, Jefferson. And thanks for the moving report from NRF. In the process of oversight, we also learn.
Sure.
And every time I come out of this meeting, I feel much better, much different from before. I'm going to ask a question that looks like teaching, but it's not. It's not intended. In the mandate of the NRF, says to promote and support research through, in order to, and thereby, to contribute to the improvement of the quality of life of all the people of the Republic of South Africa. Now, I'm struggling to link that with the investment page, the seven investment areas. What page is that, Governor? Page 19. In that page, we have this investment of the budget, and then the last line of that page is community engagement research. And it's used to 0.2%. The question is not intended to catch, but it's just in its nature, it's sort of a catchy question. But the idea here is to get clarity of where the strategy is taking us to.
Sure.
The second question is on the following page after that one, which is page 20, I suppose. The NRF is currently funding 40% of the fundable research projects and 30% of the student applications. I'm not sure if that really creates an impression that the 70% of students' applications cannot be funded. And if so, I think it's an area of concern, given what the last two of my colleagues have just mentioned about building a researcher from foundation, that it would be... It's a matter that would need a little bit of attention. The other area of concern that I want us not to pass by is the issue of the inflation versus the MTES budgeting process. That in the light of this and with the inflation going in the direction it goes now, I anticipate the risk. In relation to us achieving the mandate with the MTEF budget system. And maybe some kind of discussion needs to take place around that area. The last part is the issue of the workshop you referred to, as to whether the committee would have access to that workshop.
Thank you very much. Chair or President?
Very much. Well, first I could just pick up on the MTEF question, which was highlighted in Professor Margalisa's presentation. Well, indeed, the situation is in plain terms as we see it in the papers. And to bring it down to its essentials, we have an MTEF increase which is below the current rate of inflation, and therefore after one is factored into the calculations various essential shifts that should have to take place, think about salary negotiations and the like. There are indeed quite dire consequences for the research community in respect of research grants and scholarships and bursaries as well. So all I can do, I guess, Chair, is simply to endorse very strongly the plea that came earlier from the CEO to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee for assistance in addressing what for the NRF is a very serious issue.
Thank you very much. Are we able to address this question of the students, the 70% students? Dr. Van Yasser?
Thank you, Chair. I can just give a quick answer. The reality is that we would like to fund many, many more students in our system. We would, looking at the list, the 30% that we can fund is simply what we can afford with the money we have on the table. It's as simple as that. Then when the money runs out, you know, we go through a process of assessing students, and we have to look at transformation and all those issues and try and get a nice balanced portfolio of people we invest in. At the end of the day, we get a lot of applications. We can only fund 30% of the ones that actually apply. We could double that money and spend it all in a year based on the number of applications we get, and all of them are fundable in that sense. So the issue is as dire as it is with the projects as far as the students are concerned.
Quickly on the question of the workshop to the National Research Facilities that we're planning for April, the Honourable Slao, perhaps we can talk about that and through you, Chair, be able to give you an outline of what we plan to do and see to what extent members of the committee can have access to that or participate in.
No, thank you very much. In April, they'll be expected to be in their constituencies. Just ensuring that they did what that 2% that you still have to respond to.
Okay. The other 2%, the 0.2%, actually, I thought Dr. Van Yarsholt was going to talk to it, but I think that maybe you can speak a little bit better to it, because I had trouble with that number myself.
I think
it's not 2%.
No, it's 0.2%, but I think the point is, yeah, we need to read carefully that this is an investment in research and community engagement. In other words, trying to do research as to what's effective or not. We spend a lot more money in community engagement throughout our programs and throughout our facilities and the platforms we put in place, which is not captured in this figure, but I think the point you raise is good for clarity.
This is why I thought we would put that number and put the other one too, how much we spend on community engagement. But we just put this one alone, and alone it can be misleading because it makes people think that only 0.2% of all the resources allocated to the area of good community engagement. That's right, yeah.
If you want doctors and PhDs, they want answers. They can come around. So I think we must deflect this matter and engage more, isn't it?
Yeah.
We'll come back to them just to see that what other programs are in making impact in communities.
Yeah.
All right. You're the last one.
Chairperson, thank you. To what extent do you collaborate or work together or work as friends with SASOL? Because it seems to be having quite a good budget to promote the development of PhDs. On a lighter note, you told us that there were 13 learners that participated in the competition and 5 won. How many girls did win? We are at this point in time reaping the fruits of Bantu education, and it's going to be with us for quite a long time, particularly around the issue of research and development. We are aware that most communities are saying, research, research, research. What is in there for us? we are really dealing with issues of Bantu education. How do you think research in general will begin to address that? In fact, I think I am also dealing with questions that were asked by the previous colleagues, that how about starting them from small around making research a likable subject and an important subject, including math and science and many other things. As an NRF, I'm sure you are funding a whole range of research projects, programs, and whatever. We are having a lot of councils reporting to us. They are doing research on various aspects. How do you, as the umbrella body, begin to collaborate and coordinate the various research that has been done towards improving innovation in South Africa and maybe towards bridging the gap that we have in innovation? How much are you involved in that? And because of time, we are saying we've got a lot of graduates, but most of our graduates come from Bantu education. The educators themselves are a product of Bantu education. The graduates are a product of Bantu education. But we've got a lot of them who have been trained and they've got degrees. To what extent do you think you can assist in retraining or developing with universities a retraining program to get these people to become good researchers and to get these people to begin to come up with a whole range of things, even products for commercialization? To what extent do you think you can assist in that? And finally, do you think you can commission a research to research universities around their production, productivity, and whatever, so that 2020 and beyond, we might be getting what we've been complaining about, what Honorable Blanche has been complaining about, Nefula Bodo has been complaining about, and all of us, so that we do not say internationals and nationals. We are now talking about researchers because we brought the level up on time. And do you think you'd also be in the process of demystifying research? Thank you.
The mouthful, man.
Thank you, Chair. I think Honorable Ngobo is, touched on some very, very hot topics here, very hard topics, and topics that are mind-opening, that help us go to the next level, really, especially when you're hitting on the retraining of the people who are products of a very bad system that has been designed not to make them assess the research culture, so to speak. How do we turn that around and create and have people who have been turned around in that sense? It's going to be a very tough order. So all the questions were tough, but luckily I am surrounded by a very capable colleague there. Professor Reddy was the Dean of Science for many years, and Professor Fanny Asprez was also Dean, so they might have answers here. I'll take a stab at them myself, starting with the learners in astronomy that you talked about, in that astronomy contest. The contest was among schools, not among individuals. So we had teams of five from every school. And there were 15 schools. How they were selected, I don't remember. But of those 15 that contested, five emerged. Of the five, I think one was from Bloemfontein, one was from the Western Cape. These other three were either mixed or were, two were definitely from historically disadvantaged communities, Soshanguve and another one. I regarded those five as all winners. And among them were girls and boys. If you look at the slide that shows them there, they were mixed in terms of gender and race. So it was an attempt. For me, it was a reflection that these things can be done, and girls can be equally competitive in science as boys are. The Bantu education problem and research question, I think, as you know, Honorable Ngobo,
architect of apartheid wanted us not to participate in anything that has to do with science or mathematics. They are, you know, I don't want to go into that. How do we turn it around? Because there's a culture of research. I'm sorry, I'll just make this quiet. There is a culture that goes along with the training of people in order for them to participate in research, that when you look at the product of the system of value education, it's missing. In fact, it's really shameful when you look at the CVs of people who came from our system, from the value education system, and compare someone of the same age who came from the other system. The value education system, a person would have very few lists of publications there, because the writing was not part of the culture that was inculcated. What are we doing about that as an NRF? And I can go into all sorts of problems and describing the problems surrounding the outcome of the one education. What we're doing at the NRF, as I said there, we are going to monitor transformation and reward it when necessary. Part of transformation is to implore and urge researchers to partner with people from historically disadvantaged communities, those who are prolific publishers. We want to see them in the teams that they have, that they are people from historically disadvantaged groups. There are women in there. And it's starting to pay off. Tomorrow we'll be evaluating a group of people who are applying for a rating in the NRF. When they submit their CVs, we want to see who they publish with. And it's a long way to go still, because what I notice is a tendency for people.
It's also gone.
It's gone.
Let's check this side.
What
energy crisis I was talking about.
We need photovoltaic, not solar. What I've noticed, Chair, is that the researchers now will promote masters and PhD students to the extent that those students can contribute to their own research. In other words, they'll handpick those who can write, and those who cannot write are left behind. And the emerging picture there is a saddening one, because you're seeing, again, a partnership with people who were trained outside of South Africa in countries where the governments were there for the last 40 years. So they're exposed to high-powered education in those countries. Come here in South Africa and are able to come in and write. People who are born and raised there, you can see by the name sometimes. There are very few. Then the professors will take them through conferences. You see them teaming up in conferences. But when it comes to ISI papers, the very same students who are in that conference are dropped now. Their names are not in the publication where it counts, which is that journal, the A-rated journal. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing, in a very subtle way, we're now moving more aggressively to say we want to see these people be involved in journals as well. Even though they might not be the ones to write, but if they contributed ideas, that's the way you inculcate the culture. But in the long run, I think it's bringing people like Professor Ray to go and spend time in Germany and come and speak the way he was speaking here. He would not have spoken like this if he never went to Germany. That way we can transform the system here and get people moving. So it's a very tall order that we're fighting, but we will try. How the NRF is collaborating with others to bridge the gap, especially in innovation and other things, now is something that the NRF is placed very, very strategically, particularly with the emergence of the TIA, because we are going to be overlapping with TIA, and make sure that whatever gets done at TIA is in synergy, synergized with what gets done at the NRF, and also to bring out the best in places like the MRC, which also does similar kinds of research in a different way, and other science councils. We are constantly in contact with other science councils in that sense, because we have a cohort meeting that brings together all the science councils to talk about the research proposals we have. We have one-on-one bilateral with many others. HSRC and NRF tend to have these one-on-ones to talk about common problems and common issues in the social sciences and so on and so forth. Commissioning someone to work with universities to demystify research as we move to 2020, I think is a project, again, that we will take out of this discussion and think about the ways to do it as we move forward, because I think that it's important that at the end of the day, like you said, Honorable Noble, we should talk about researchers rather than national and non-national in that sense of the word. But, until that ideal point is reached, to me, it seems like there's a lot of work that still needs to be done here at home in the area of research in turning the culture among, especially those of historical disadvantaged communities. Thank you.
No, I'll come back to you, Doctor. Professor, I don't know your time is.
My time is up.
Yeah, the ball is in your court. If you want to still enjoy the party, go ahead. Want to catch your flight, you can just do that. I don't know. I know. I suspect the reason why this is off is because I said some people shall speak in this meeting.
So you were sabotaged.
Yeah. All right. You know, I think this was quite useful. And we've got to take forward this engagement with the NRM. We still want to engage your coordination and collaboration with other side councils, particularly how effective are the co-ops, how is the system working and so on, because we've seen a disjuncture in our own engagement with them in terms of all this. And also this whole notion that let's catch our students young. You know, we visited some of the Dinaledi schools and the infrastructure itself is very disappointing. You see, you go to a science lab or whatever you say, but it's the same as where I was when I was How do we, what I'm saying is that we still have a lot of money. You see? And the HSRC has made some research in terms of actually also intake into the labor market, depending on which school you came from. There is this type of discrimination that we have to look into. You know, there is this new phenomenon, it's not new, because some of you have taken some gap years before for a long time. Our students, their organization that are starting to say, give your students some gap years to go abroad, experience, come back, they come back like better. I don't know whether that system is working, whether it's something worth looking into, and so on and so on. But there are a lot of things that I haven't raised any questions. I think I'll reserve them for when we have a longer meeting. Chair, I'm going to give you the last word. Just now, Prof, last thing before you leave, end, because I want to give you the last bite with the chair. But I'm going to take everybody, what or not, on the mic. Can't come all the way from the door. Just come and sit right here. No, not yet.
No, Chair, I just want to reiterate what I always feel about coming to this committee, is that I appreciate the opportunity to exchange our ideas with you, because I think that more than anyone, as far as we are interacting with at the NRF, you are the ones who help us remain on top.
Sure.
With all the tough questions you ask, that includes every member of the PTC. They are very helpful to us, because when we go and implement our mandate, we want to be able to say that if we don't do that, the PTC will call us to task and say, why are you doing this? And the reason you're doing it is because you're responsive to the people of South Africa. And so, as I said before, you are the policy makers, and I think that all the information you give us, all the input and the encouragement, as well as the disappointments that Mr. Bradshaw was mentioning, those are very important, because that's the voice of the people of South Africa. We take it. Thank you very much.
People of South Africa.
Enjoy your trip.
Thank you very much.
We have about 9 minutes just to wrap up. We've got a finger lunch also behind us, so we're not going to, from here it will be taking a piece and so on. I'm going to start with Dr. I've got 1 minute, but you can take 10 if you have.
Thanks, Chair, for the opportunity. What I would like to say, based on the discussion this morning, in my first meeting at the PTC Workshop, and from my side, from the knowledge management side, and how we can actually add value into the national system, what I'm going to say is that, particularly regarding our strategy and the implementation, is really the core activity that is going to unfold within the higher education sector is the issue of the areas of knowledge field development, IPS, that collaboration that we have with the researchers as part of knowledge management, that information, that technical explicit knowledge, it is documented, who has access to them, and how it is disseminated. That's what we'll take forward. And also the issue of assisting graduates to become researchers, how do we actually do that? The issue of making research efforts a and output benefit the country. We have at the moment where we are touched by the national, the higher education institution to say, we want the National Research Foundation to look into the issue of where the data accumulated, where the information. We need a hub, a central place, a repository, a home, where we can actually go without paying a cent or a fee to access the information. That's the dilemma at the moment. We have researchers coming out abroad and coming to the country to research and taking back. When we want to do that, we have to buy a resource or a database to access it. And that's where we come in with our network of data and information curation centers that we are trying to co-host as an institution. Also the issue of the electronic piece and dissertation project, where at the moment with our students are doing research. You do your research, your master's or doctorate, it goes to the shelf or the archive. We don't have it electronically. Other students don't use a duplicate the research effort that you have. And that's what we're looking at the country to say. As a National Research Foundation, you are tasked to oversee and ensure that there's access, the dissemination and digitization of all this access. So that's what it's coming that when we come next year, we'll say, this is how much is made available and is digitized. We can claim it. And also the data set and information that we have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Master Max.
Well, I was going to share with the committee that as a secretary of this group that I have captured everything that you've
Thank you very much. That's well said. Short and sweet. Mr. Krieger?
Thank you, Chair and members. I think that's something that has appeared throughout the questions, although they may have been directed at particular issues. For me, quite important in terms of the disjunctures you spoke about earlier. And these are the system disjunctures which Professor Mangalisa also referred to at the beginning of the presentation. And I think it's incumbent upon the committee to assist the NRF and the other players in the system to resolve some of these disjunctures. And I think you are well aware, you served on the education committee previously, of what these are that I refer to. And that is the policy domain of the Department of Education vis-a-vis that of the Department of Science and Technology, vis-a-vis the Department of Labor with regards to the Integrated Human Resource Development Strategy. And it is like a voice in the wilderness when we speak of these disjunctures but do nothing about them. So I think the plea of the NRF in those first two slides was actually to assist us to resolve and untie some of these knots in the system. And the second point related to that is the issue of your role of oversight. I think your oversight is not only with regard to how we spend our money, but also how the money is appropriated. And I think that it is equally important that in the preparation for the appropriation, you call on the expertise within the NRF to assist you to judge what is happening or to recommend changes in that. I worked for many years in Germany, serving the federal state government of Baden-Württemberg. The Secretary of State will be here next week in the Western Cape. They have a bilateral with the Western Cape government, and part of the resolutions they've taken before the trip is to assist the local, the provincial and the national government to actually look at how one appropriates for education in these various facilities. So on one hand, we call on your services to mediate, and on the other hand, we offer our services to where you require some.
Thank you very much. Ms. Pilar Marais? Yes?
Thanks for the opportunity. I must say that every time I find this an outstanding teaching experience. I would like to think that on both things, over the broad range of interventions and institutions, we're all working towards what Trevor Manuel basically referred to as an innovative economy and not an escalating economy. do not all rush for the excavator, and then only a few can get up. We want to get people up as we go along. And that is where I see the work of the NRD, that's quite interesting. We're starting from tasks of school kids, getting them into the system, and getting them going through the student phase, through the research phase, so that we can feed into the work of the village here. So thanks for the opportunity and for the questions.
Thank you very much. It's only your machine that's working.
The NRF at the end of the day is about people. No matter how you try to slice it and dice it, it's all about people. Which is why the NRF founding statement ends up with the quality of life of people. I just want to highlight one of the very important initiatives that has not been spoken about during this discussion, which addresses somehow or partly the pipeline issues that we all to agree that they are hindrances. That has to do with the fact that there are thousands of unemployed graduates out there. That the NRF, among other departments, together with the Department of Science and Technology, a very novel project, the internship program, which is intended within the context of NRF district to recycle people back into the system. We've been running that for 2 years now. Initially started off with about 60 graduates. We've increased that to about 96. And we are hoping that we can catch at least 80% of those people coming back into the system to do science. I thought I would highlight it. One of those very small but very impactful kind of interventions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Singh.
Sir, thank you for having us here. It is my second or third time that I've been to this committee, and what I find interesting each time that I come back here is that you learn so much more about what we do, but at the same time, we also take back the things that we find gaps that we need to plug. In the role that I play in the NRF, money certainly matters, but what you do on your side is ensure that performance counts, and you keep that check and balance on us. But what we also like to share is that our engagement that Robert talked about in the appropriation, with regard to association with that, it is not always visible up front in terms of the impact that we have. And as the catalytic role that we play in the bigger system somehow needs to be transferred by you through to National Treasury, that this has a longer maturing term in the system as a whole, and therefore it is becoming increasingly difficult for us to make the case to National Treasury when the Treasury themselves seeks to have an impact almost immediately. It's easier to appropriate money for housing, for roads, for infrastructure. But in what you've heard today, it has a longer maturing period in the sense that it will plow back, but not almost immediately. So thank you for having us here, and maybe take our case forward.
No, sir, thank you very much. You're speaking, I'm coming to Dr. Sibanda. As you're speaking, I'm looking at the delegation leaders. I normally do that. You've seen that all members of the portfolio committee have spoken. And I'm not worried when I'm sitting here. Whatever they say is fine. So I look at the delegation, the chair and the vice, whether they are worried if you're speaking. Well, sometimes they are just worried that you might raise your grievances about
we might be there.
I'm hoping that we don't say that. No, thank you very much. Over to you. You've got 1 minute.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think the feedback that we've received from the for the committee has been very useful. I think as we move forward, I think it's become quite clear that the chasm that the Honourable Noble referred to, the innovation chasm, is really comprised of the funding gap, the skills gap, and the culture gap. So the NRF has got a big role to play in terms of such a bridge of those two things in the innovation chasm to make sure that the work that gets done does contribute to the growth of the economy and also to improving the lives of our men.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr.
Fania.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There were things that you wanted to say earlier, and now is the time.
No, I was just some information, but I don't think it's the time to share. I just have to say, I think I've seen enough. Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's good to be here, and good to see all of you.
Thank you very much. Trump,
it's yours. Thank you, Chair. So you want my reaction? Well, let me first of all thank you, Chair, for giving my previously silent colleagues an opportunity to speak, because the collective voices that have summarized the situation and this morning's proceedings far better than I think I would be able to. We've picked up on all of the key issues, but it's as well to come back to the oversight of the portfolio committee, the fact that we are held accountable. We are measured against our mandate. We are reminded about our mandate, and these are very, very important issues, close to the heart of what the NRF is all about. So we've had a long discussion this morning about the verified atmosphere of research on the one hand, on the other hand, the national problems of this country, improving the quality of life of the people in this country. That's what we say in our mandate. How do we bring these together? How do we address national objectives? How do we become, at the same time, part of the global community of researchers? We've talked a lot about that, and about the role of innovation. And then, of course, down the track, quite rightly, we've been asked, well, how do you measure this? How do you persuade us that you are doing a good job, that you are succeeding, and so on? And that is equally important. And all of these activities can be measured and are measured, and this is information that we must share with you. I'm pleased that a number of times in the course of our proceedings, we've had the opportunity to highlight the difficult financial situation that we find ourselves in and are likely to be finding ourselves in in the near future. In response to a question, and will come from in the presentation as well. And I've given a brief indication, Chair, to why it is as serious as it is. I've talked about bursaries, research grants. I should also have mentioned our national facilities. Just the business of looking after equipment, maintaining it, let alone upgrading and renewing it, is a very expensive matter. And we are very worried about exactly how we are going to be able to do that. So any assistance that we can have from the portfolio will be very, very much appreciated. Chair, just one or two other brief points. I want to come back to the Honourable Noble's comment or words about demystifying research. That really gets to the heart of it. You know, research is not it's not the fancy activity that is only for the future. Anybody can do it. One inquiry about finding out what do I know, how do I get to know about something, what are the rules, what are the ethics about it, and so on. And these are values that one can inculcate in children from a very young age onward. So absolutely, it's not something that is just for us to make to you. And I think that we would do well to take your word seriously about the broadening of the whole notion of research and having it captured amongst all in our population, including our children. Chair, you mentioned right at the beginning or somewhere along the way about the possibility of visiting the national facilities at the NRF. I think the last time I was here, we talked about the possibility of a meeting or some sort of engagement with the NRF board. In fact, we did try, but the diary just didn't work out. I would like to continue trying and also to see whether we can find an opportunity for further committee members to see something of at least some of the national facilities. They are quite remarkable facilities, and that we really would love to share with committee members. I mean, finally, Chair, it just remains for me to thank you and to thank members of the committee for what has once again been a very enriching experience for us. Some of the questions, many of the questions have been tough, kept us on our toes. We have a lot to take away from here and to think about and to introduce into our planning and our activities, which will help to improve the work of the NRF. So, again, thank you very much for the opportunity.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. I think I must adjourn this meeting just before I do that. Thank members, honorable members, and our guests. I've not started to make them speak yet as well, but thanks for coming. You are part of the portfolio committee. Some of you are very prominent members of wherever we are. We see you around quite interested in that. We still have to come back to you and say, report to us, what have you been doing in our meeting? all this time, but we're also looking forward to a forum where we'll have politicians and scientists to talk to each other. You see, so that you understand where we come from, what we, our concerns are, what our communities are saying, and what can, you know, I always raise one example that I've raised when I joined this committee to say, you know, in 1994, as politicians, one project that we got into was the project of housing. And we said 1 million houses in 5 years or so on. So, quite noble. And President Mandela was driving that program. We are shifting. But the quality of those houses, you see? And even today, we still proceed with some of those houses, RDP houses, some of the Zinyao, the Zaudi Morgan. You sleep and you use your tall, the outside. But I said, scientists, you are failing us. We said that to the CSIR. What are you doing? We made mistakes for 10 years, at least it's fine. But after 10 years, you should have called us and said, no. This is the type of low-cost housing that we're looking for South Africa. Can we try this model and see if it works? You see, I just made that example. But there are others to say that it's important that we should speak. But we're still trying to coordinate politicians here because HSRC is doing research, human research that touch on a lot of other departments. But that curation of that research, madam, that's where you don't see a connection. There is a disconnect. But I can say a lot about that as well. Lucky, we have not even spoken about this review ourselves even here in this meeting. But there are a lot of issues that I think we still have to engage in. This is a work in progress. We will not be able to get Ampura's guns to practice. They are doing from the office. Kids Corp and others would fund us. We have some opportunity. We'll engage with you, Chair, to how we take some of this. Thank you very much, the Minister. John, please say goodbye to everybody. Thank you.
Maybe I was thinking Anthony.
We have a rally in Mpumalanga this coming weekend.
Okay.
You are living in
Cape
Town.
Oh, excuse me? Oh, sorry, I don't have it. Yeah.